I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We do have a quorum, although it doesn't really matter because today is just an informational hearing. And before we get to our agenda, I just wanted to go through a few housekeeping items. Everyone here today must be seated when they're in the hearing room. There's no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need any other accommodations, please let the sergeant staff know. Signs aren't permitted in the hearing room or at the testifiers table. Clapping and other disruptions are not allowed. Also, testifiers have been provided with a time limit. But I just wanted to, now that those housekeeping items are over, just kind of give an overview as to why we are here today. And first, I just want to say thank you to the members and to staff for being here today. I know it's a really busy time of year, and so appreciate your efforts being here, to our testifiers for coming. We've got some incoming members to the Public Safety Committee who are also here today in the audience and probably listening online as well. So thank you to them for being proactive. Also, I brought treats, so if you want to start passing those along, feel free. And just to kind of give a background here, as you recall, during the last legislative session, when we were actually in session, we talked about the need to have a deeper dive into corrections-related issues, just because there are so many issues, and we really can't cover them in the course of a regular hearing time. Even having a full afternoon dedicated to it isn't enough. We're just going to be able to scratch the surface. In addition to that, we really want to think about both short-term and long-term solutions for corrections. I know that many of us have had an opportunity to tour different facilities, to talk to people who were incarcerated or formerly incarcerated, and there are a whole host of issues, from crumbling infrastructure to healthcare and treatment needs, to those facing isolation and communication challenges while they're incarcerated, to safety of our staff members, and to challenges in reentry. Again, this is just so many things that it's really difficult for us to cover in a regular session, and so just so that we're able to now gather some information and start thinking about how we can be creative both in the short and the long term. I've also had the opportunity to meet with corrections staff and legislators from other states during the last two interims. And what really struck me is that some of the reforms that are being done around the country are nonpartisan reforms. They're happening in both blue states and in red states. And as we're thinking about the upcoming session and what it's going to look like to co-govern, I think this is a perfect opportunity to look at promising practices from around the country and other nations that I truly believe are bipartisan in nature. And so it's sort of a good segue into what's coming for the next session. As I said, today the purpose is going to be to listen to the testifiers, and members will have an opportunity for Q&A at the end of all the testimony. So if you can just make a note of your questions, and we'll get to that at the end of the hearing. We don't have any pages today, and so for the testifiers signing in, Christian has the sign-in sheets, so just make sure before you leave you have an opportunity to sign in. And with that, we're going to begin with the Commissioner of Corrections, Paul Schnell. Welcome back to the committee. Commissioner, please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. My name is Paul Schnell, and I serve as the Commissioner of Corrections for the state of Minnesota. Thank you for having us here today to provide you with a brief overview of the agency, some requested updates in key areas, implementation status updates, and I'll also touch on some of our challenges and successes. As a reminder, the DOC's mission is to transform lives for a safer Minnesota. And the work done in corrections is of critical importance to Minnesota's public safety. While the state's correction system must serve the retributive and incapacitation objectives of the state, we know that solely punitive responses to crime have not resulted in crime reduction goals. Why not? Because retribution doesn't address the underlying issues that may have contributed to the offending, such as trauma or social conditions, substance use disorders, or mental health problems. Research shows the criminal justice objective of deterrence is less associated with the level of punishment a person receives through their sentencing, whereas the deterrence objective is better served when the likelihood of being caught is higher. The DOC's mission-driven focus on creating transformational opportunities for participation in programs and services or correctional interventions that research shows will address criminogenic risk factors. Our steadfast focus must be on risk reduction interventions that will reduce reoffending, reduce criminal justice system costs, and more than anything, result in fewer victims. The DOC has approximately 4,300 employees working in our facilities, central office, and in community supervision across the state. The DOC operates 11 prisons with a combined capacity of 9,500 beds, though that number reflects double bunking across the system. Currently, there are approximately 8,200 individuals in our prisons. Our total facilities footprint spans more than 7 million square feet. Beyond our prisons, the DOC provides community supervision to around 20,000 individuals in the community across 13 district supervision offices statewide. In addition, the DOC works closely with our county-based community supervision partners, as Minnesota has more than 80,000 people on some level of community supervision across the state. The DOC is also responsible for inspecting and licensing jails and juvenile detention facilities. Minnesota's prison system has four levels of security classification for adults: maximum, close, medium, and minimum. Shakopee is the state's only women's prison, which houses all security levels. Taking a look at the demographic profile of those incarcerated within Minnesota's prison, the average age of individuals in our prison system is 39.9 years of age. The average length of stay is approximately 36 months. We have 627 individuals in our prison serving life sentence, including 167 serving life without the possibility of parole. More than 80% of individuals in our system have a high school diploma, GED or higher. Importantly, and it's important to point out that nearly 70% of those in our prisons are parents to minor children. Why is this important? Because we know that having a parent in prison can dramatically increase the risk of system involvement for their children. Not surprisingly, effectively intervening to reduce the criminogenic risk of incarcerated parents can reduce the risk of system involvement for their children. Minnesota has notable racial disparities in our population, with 37% identified as African American or Black, compared to a state population total of approximately 12.4%. American Indian people represent 9% of the state's prison population, compared to 1% of the state's population overall. This slide provides a range of other key data points that are helpful to having a wider understanding of the state's incarcerated population. I won't read through them for time's sake, but they're all important considerations for you as policymakers. The DOC is a 24/7, 365 state agency. The work simply never stops, and neither do the dedicated staff who ensure that our facilities remain safe and that individuals in our care are given the tools they need to transform their lives. Across the state, community supervision agents provide around-the-clock correctional supervision as well. We work to engage and support crime victims by working closely with county attorney-based victim witness staff and community-based victim advocacy organizations across Minnesota. 96% of the DOC's operating budget comes from the state's general fund. We strive to be transparent, responsive, and accountable in what we do, ensuring that our work comports with the laws enacted by you as our legislative leaders and aligns with the trust placed in us by the people of Minnesota. We've been relentlessly focused on recruitment as we talk about staffing, recognizing the critical role that employees play in the success of our mission. The DOC is currently operating at a 97% staffing level across the agency, which is higher than it's been since before the start of this administration in 2019. Critical to our staffing level were the historic and critically needed increases in compensation for correctional officers and correction staff generally. While compensation increases made the DOC competitive, we know that pay is just one factor. In 2023, the legislature also provided funding for staff support and wellness initiatives that are also important to our retention strategy. And I want to thank this committee for the role you all played in helping to stabilize the DOC corrections workforce. Your investments mattered, and they are paying off. We are working hard to focus some attention on overtime, and we're doing this for two reasons. One is to make sure that overtime is commensurate with our vacancies and our business needs, and two, to reduce the use of forced overtime on staff, which reduces staff safety overall and is contrary to our retention goals. While overtime is down, there are a couple of factors driving higher overtime costs, which I'll talk about later in the presentation. As we think about safety, ensuring safety in our prisons must always be a top priority. You likely saw or heard about DOC staff who were overcome by exposure to suspected synthetic narcotics, which has been an issue in prison systems across the nation. To address the safety risk for staff, we piloted a number of initiatives to reduce the introduction of synthetic narcotic contraband into our facilities by launching a new mail handling process. One key improvement we made was engaging in a contract with a third-party vendor who scans, copies, and forwards mail to the respective correctional facility for distribution by staff. The contractor has, in this case, the needed equipment, venting systems, and mailing processing procedures that would be cost prohibitive for the state to replicate. And the process significantly decreases the likelihood of illicit substances entering our prisons through paper mail making, which ultimately makes the facility safer. And I would point out that the we did attempt on our own to do some of this, where we scanned and photocopied mail for distribution to our population. And in just one facility for 1 month, the cost of the toner to make copies hit the $20,000 mark. So as we think about just the cost and the staff time that was required, the third-party vendor option was the best and frankly a cheaper option than pulling our staff out to do that. As it also relates to safety, just this month, following procurement and policy development efforts, the DOC launched the legislatively funded body-worn camera pilot. This pilot is initially focused on Lino Lake, Shakopee, and Stillwater facilities, and as well for piloting by our DOC intensive supervised release agents across the state. This pilot was funded, as I said, in the 2023 session, and the project comports with the 2020 OLA report on prison safety, which highlighted the significant need to enhance data collection and security technology. Additionally, in 2022, the Ombuds for Corrections issued a report on sexual assault in prisons, and they recommended that correctional officers be equipped with body cameras for the safety of staff and the incarcerated population alike. As was the case with body camera use by law enforcement, the use of body cameras, we believe, will help increase transparency. The use of body-worn cameras in correctional facilities will improve investigations into prison rape elimination act reports, the investigation and prosecution of assaults of DOC staff by incarcerated persons, or investigating reports of inappropriate or excessive use of force by DOC staff. Also, on the safety front, in addition to the body cameras, the DOC implemented a variety of other recommendations from the 2020 OLA report. The range of efforts includes establishing the Office of Professional Accountability, reducing double bunking in our facilities, increasing communication, and the others listed here on this slide. As it relates to OLA, the OLA made a significant portion of their report focused on issues of the DOC needing to address bullying and harassment among staff. And they cited the 2020 MMB report findings that the DOC had the highest rate of sexual harassment among large state agencies. The OLA heard from many staff they interviewed that their coworkers and supervisors did not take harassment seriously. Today, as many as one-third of the investigations referred to the DOC's Office of Professional Accountability are sexual harassment related. Sexual harassment cases are very complex, time-consuming, and demand a level of expertise and training to properly investigate. The DOC's Office of Professional Accountability faced its own staffing challenges, which, when combined with the high volume of reports, resulted in lengthy investigation times that created challenges for both reporting victims of harassment and those accused as well. To this end, earlier this year, we initiated an RFP for a sexual harassment institutional audit. The objective was engaging a third-party expert to conduct a thorough, unbiased, and evidence-based audit to help us better understand the range of issues and to identify process improvement recommendations. The firm who conducted the audit will be submitting their final report to us in the coming days, and we look forward to sharing that with the legislature. The audit and our commitment to following through on the recommendations underscores the DOC's commitment to addressing sexual harassment and creating a safe and respectful workplace for all employees. We also look forward to working closely with our labor partners to not just respond better when a report is received, but to find ways to help prevent sexual harassment and bullying in the workplace. Next, I'll talk a little bit about infrastructure needs. This was also an area of focus for the OLA, the need for improvements to DOC infrastructure. The numbers on the slide speak for itself. The DOC holds one-third of the deferred maintenance needs of all state assets managed by state agencies. The estimated cost of improving all DOC infrastructure to just fair condition is $723 million. Currently, the department has 16 buildings that are in crisis condition and 61 buildings regarded as in poor condition. As many of you who've toured Stillwater and St. Cloud know, the significant cost is due to the age and complexity of these facilities. Beyond the buildings themselves, the facilities host extensive, complex, and costly security systems that require ongoing maintenance. As we think about the infrastructure needs and safe staff safety and wellness, this context cannot be overlooked. That the facilities are 24/7 living environments to, as mentioned, over 8,000 people. And we must maintain spaces conducive to rehabilitation. Beyond condition, the age of many of our prison facilities, when compared with modern design standards, do not meet current safety standards and are considerably more expensive to operate. Working corrections is among the most challenging across our state enterprise, I believe. And we know that when our staff feel valued, it translates to improved services to our population. And the facilities they work in are just one of the ways we demonstrate our commitment to staff and the value of their work. While addressing the DOC's deferred maintenance needs is critical to ensuring safety, equally important is expanding the available space for programming. Currently, 65% of the DOC's incarcerated population is engaged in some form of programming. At any given time in the state's correctional facilities, about 1,000 people are participating in substance use disorder treatment, and another 300 individuals are in sex offender-specific treatment programming. The DOC and our state higher education partners are providing 680 people in our prisons with access to post-secondary education. And on any given day, more than 1,100 people are engaged in working in the DOC's MinCorps Industries program, which helps participants gain work skills and work experience that can aid in their reentry. In addition, the DOC provides an array of agency-operated programming like mental health, cognitive skills, intimate partner violence programming, along with volunteer and community-based programs like Prison Fellowship Academy, Effective Parenting Classes, Art from the Inside, and Prison Writers Workshops, to name a few. Despite the value of these programs, there are limitations based on available programming space at several of our facilities across the state. Programming limitations causes increased numbers of idle incarcerated people, which creates increased safety risks for both staff and the population. Additionally, data shows that warehousing, which is what occurs when incarcerated people are idle, can increase recidivism by as much as 13%. Investing in infrastructure improvement and expansion provides greater access to these programs, which increases opportunities for individuals to demonstrate their change. I'd like to turn the attention now to the issue of health care within the Department of Corrections. The DOC has both a statutory and constitutional obligation to provide health care and a standard of living for those subject to incarceration. You should know that the health of the incarcerated population is worse than the general public overall due to a variety of factors, including things like poverty, neglect, and even systemic racism. We see the increasing complexity of health issues of those in our facility, with many requiring chronic disease management services. The morbidity of the correctional population results in a growing need for access to specialized medical services. Given the extensive medical needs of so many in the population, there is also a demand for comprehensive medical case planning and coordination, and the need for our medical providers to address the acute medical needs of people in the population often leaves less time for providers to devote to less urgent but still necessary health care needs of those in our population. As you can see in the data, a significant portion of our population in the DOC requires mental health care, while many others face complex medical or health conditions. The severity and scope of the health needs places considerable strain on our resources and on our medical staff and providers. Similar to Minnesota's population overall, the state's correctional population is also aging. The aging correctional population presents a unique challenge that will continue to require both a special and escalating need for policymakers' attention. Our mostly dated correctional facilities were simply not designed to meet the needs of older individuals with difficult staircases, limited or no elevator access, narrow hallways, and small cells that cannot accommodate medical beds or large wheelchairs. The DOC is currently serving a growing number of individuals with dementia, so much so that we are engaged in planning for what may be a future legislative discussion about the potential need for us to develop a dementia unit to meet the significant needs of this group. Beyond dementia, the older population has higher rates of chronic and co-occurring health conditions. And finally, you should know that care coordination upon reentry can be particularly difficult for this population, as they are often not accepted in community-based care settings because of their offending history. The healthcare needs of our population directly impact our security staffing. Hospitalizations or trips to specialty care appointments are resource intensive, requiring two officers to escort the individual, which removes those officers from our prisons for hours and in some cases days at a time. As mentioned earlier, this results in extensive use of overtime, because we have to backfill the posts that these staff who were providing these transports or hospital coverage need to be filled. The chronic conditions I highlighted earlier frequently require numerous off-site specialty clinic visits, further exacerbating our challenges. The next chart slide shows the number of off-site specialty care visits completed in 23 and 24. and the average number of trips per month across our 11 facilities is just over 550. Between July 1 and September 30th of 24, there was 350 emergency room visits. Of these, 60% were transported via state DOC state cars, while 40% required ambulance transport. Annually, we average about four medical transports via helicopter across our system. About 29% of those visits resulted in admissions for further treatment, with the primary reasons for these visits being abdominal pain, chest pain, overdoses, or seizures. The average length of stay for inpatient care was 3.3 days, totaling 394 inpatient days during this period. While the DOC faces challenges, the DOC remains fully committed to providing high-quality, constitutionally required medical services, which is reflected in the series of innovations designed to improve outcome and control costs. This includes providing incarcerated persons with things like continuous glucose monitoring devices to proactively track blood sugar levels and reduce crisis medical incidents. Increasing access to telehealth services and improved care and treatment and planning for medically complex cases is also a core innovation. And the DOC's medical providers are prescribing those in our care with the latest biologic medications where it's clinically appropriate. And we've also worked to reduce hospital stays by transferring patients to MCF Oak Park Heights Transitional Care Unit as soon as practicable, which reduces the number of officers needed to provide hospital-based security coverage. Before I move on to discussing implementation of programs, I want to briefly discuss the DOC's work examining the use of disciplinary interventions in our facilities. Some months ago, I activated a group of staff to study the use of restrictive housing across our facilities. This group is tasked with evaluating key questions. Is restrictive housing being used in a proportionate, equitable, and consistent manner across our facilities? And most important, trying to address the question of, is it effective? The group will gather valuable information and provide recommendations to improve policies and procedures. Another area the DOC is closely evaluating is the practice and the use of extended incarceration as a form of discipline. Extended incarceration increases the amount of time individuals spend in prison by reducing their term of supervised release. The DOC imposes a total of 24 years of extended incarceration time each year. Not only is EI a costly practice for the state, but it appears on the surface to have little deterrent effect on problematic behaviors. These efforts focus on the use of restrictive housing and extended incarceration, aim to assess impact and effectiveness while also exploring alternative, more effective approaches to discipline that may provide meaningful accountability while still prioritizing rehabilitation and attention to fiscal and public safety concerns. I'm going to move on to the topic of implementation. This is the last topic I'm going to cover today, and it relates to the initiatives that were passed during this current biennium. First, one of the largest implementation efforts is planning for the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act. As you will recall, MRRA incentivizes incarcerated individuals' involvement in recidivism reduction programming to earn, an emphasis on the word earn, early release and or supervision abatement. Note that individuals with life and indeterminate sentences do not qualify for participation in MRRA. The goal of MRA is to shift the focus from the amount of time a person spends in prison to how that time is spent while they are in prison. In other words, what do they do with the time? In the spring of 2024, the DOC's newly established working groups began meeting to establish a policy framework for MRA, which was required in the statute. As we moved into the summer, efforts expanded, and we began to engage in public town halls, staff town halls, online surveys, and gathering of input from incarcerated individuals, their families, and other stakeholder groups. This fall, we entered into the policy development phase, continuing to engage the public through ongoing opportunities for feedback and information and sharing from key system partners. Looking ahead, it is the plan to publish MRA policies in January of 2025 and begin a rollout of the implementation plan. You will recall that MRA is similar in many cases to the First Step Act, which was passed on a bipartisan basis by the U.S. Congress and signed into law by then-President Trump. We anticipate and have learned much from the First Step Act and have focused extensively on our anticipated timeline for implementation. As mentioned, we will publish MRA policies and identify the retroactive review procedures in January. And in February of 2025, we will pilot the retroactive review process, focusing on process development, key takeaways, best practices, and areas that need improvement. In the spring of 2025, we will apply these insights to refine MRA policies and procedures. And by late 2025, we expect full MRA policy implementation. We know that there are some who have been critical of our planning process and implementation efforts, but we remain unapologetically focused on doing this major reform right, not fast. I want to talk about the whole issue of communication and access to phone calls. Beginning on July 1st of 2023, as you will recall, the DOC implemented free phone calls for incarcerated individuals. We immediately saw a dramatic increase in phone usage, in particular in the area of international calls. The FCC recently created rules capping the amount companies can charge correctional facilities for these communication services, and these rules will become effective next month. The FCC ruling will help keep the state's costs down by reducing these communications costs, which offsets the increased call volume, currently at approximately 7 million minutes per month. We've experienced some ongoing implementation challenges with free phone calls, particularly around security threat groups or gangs attempting to control phones and preventing or extorting others who want to have contact with their family members or loved ones. This has been a major effort of our security staff across the facilities, and we currently have a plan to roll out tablets, which are equipped with phone dialers, which over the long haul is regarded as a potential solution to the challenges that we face around access to phones. We expect the tablet rollout to occur and be completed by late spring of 2025. The side you see now is a focus on investments and implementation. This slide is not a full representation of all the initiatives that the DOC has been involved in over the past 2 years. And I must tell you how proud I am of the work of DOC staff and our governmental and non-governmental partners. I also want to extend my gratitude and appreciation to the members of this committee for your hard work, your leadership, and your thoughtfulness over the past 2 years. And finally, as we look forward to working with the new Public Safety Committee in January, we look forward to finding ways that we can achieve the state's objectives and meet the objectives of the people of our state. And with that, Madam Chair and members, I will stand for any questions any of you may have.
Thanks, Commissioner. And if you don't mind, are you able to stick around for the whole hearing so that we'll come back if folks have questions for you? I would like to note for people watching online, the materials are also available online. Representative Pinto has joined us online, and I believe Representative Tabke is in the process of joining now, too, just in case people are wondering why they're not at the table. All right, next up, we have the Office for the Ombudsperson for Corrections. It's Margaret Zadra. Welcome back to the committee. If you can please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Margaret Zadra, Ombudsperson for Corrections. Really grateful to be here.
Can you please
today.
Move your mic a little
yes,
closer?
There we go. I was trying to get it out of the way when I was setting up. Let's scoot over. All right. Margaret Zadra, Ombudsperson for Corrections. And really grateful to be here today for this conversation. The statutory mission of the Office of the Ombuds for Corrections is to promote the highest attainable standards of competence, efficiency, and justice in the administration of corrections. Our office is completely separate and independent from the Department of Corrections, and our role is to provide Our role is to review and investigate concerns from incarcerated people, corrections staff, and community members, to address systemic issues, facilitate resolutions, make recommendations to the agency, legislature, and governor's office, and publish reports. We also can provide information to help navigate what is often a confusing and complex system. Our main objectives are to provide oversight, promote efficiency, justice, enhance equity and fairness, and increase health and safety for incarcerated people, staff, and community members by improving correctional programs, policies, and practices. Our complaint volume is up almost 75% this calendar year. We've also seen more than 100% increase in in-depth investigations. We realize that this is likely in part due to a greater awareness of our office's existence and better access for incarcerated people to our office and our staff. But we've also been able to add two additional staff based on increased budget from you all in the last biennium. When we were able to do that, we were also then able to increase our workload. We saw greater resolutions because of that, and then we heard from more people based on those pieces. Even though we've had some increase to our staffing, we're still an incredibly small office. So to effectively manage what are often complex and complicated complaints and concerns, we do prioritize issues that affect health, safety, and the well-being of many people. Health and safety are also the main complaint subject areas that we hear about. And well-being issues can include items like access to programming or access to visiting with family. An example of how our office might take several well-being complaints in one area and work towards better resolutions is something we've been working on this past year with the DOC related to unexpected collateral consequences with disciplinary charges. There are often situations where incarcerated people receive discipline, such as segregation or extended incarceration, but where there may be collateral consequences that were unexpected, such as restrictions on visiting or restrictions on their access to certain types of programming. A review of this showed that people often accept those consequences for their infractions and accept that those consequences that they know about meet the severity of their infraction, and so they waive their right to a hearing, a disciplinary hearing. However, they expressed that had they known about these other collateral consequences not related to their charge, they would not have waived their right to a disciplinary hearing and would have gone through that. We see a clear need for policy updates to address collateral consequences that may not necessarily contribute to safety. And may even have a detriment long-term to safety. We know about the importance of visiting and what that does to support people. And so that those issues should be individualized based on need, and not an across-the-board, one-size-fits-all. We have made recommendations and are working with on some informal work on this to ensure changes are clear and transparent about potential consequences, including those collateral consequences, as well as reviewing for less restrictive options whenever possible. We recognize that some of these processes can take a while, and we want them to. We want them to be thorough and thought through. We also recognize that this scaffolds well with some of the other work that's happening right now around MRRA and other discipline reviews. Because this is taking a while, we are continuing to address individual concerns that arise in working with facilities as those come up. An update to some broader work related to safety in our facilities. Our office is a member of and chair of the State Correctional Facilities Security Audit Group. The group was created by the legislature in 2021 to help ensure safe and secure conditions in Minnesota's prisons. The group was required to establish security audit standards and then reported those to the legislature. After that happened, the DOC Inspection and Enforcement Unit audited the facilities, and then once those audits are complete, the security audit group then reviews those confidential security audits and makes critical safety and security recommendations to the commissioner. After 2 years of doing this work, the group found some items that needed updating, and so last session, the legislation was enacted that enhanced the group's effectiveness, including appointments from Department of Health and Department of Admin. We just had our first meeting under this new structure a week and a half ago, and it was really successful in a lot of ways. We were able to meet in person. We were able to talk through several audits in the same meeting instead of having timeline requirements to meet after each audit. It was just a much better use of the group's time. We were able to tour the facility and then do those four facility audits, and we're currently in process of finalizing those recommendations. It was a really interesting process to see how far things have come just in a couple of years, and I think in a lot of ways it was such a shining example of a powerful tool that the group is working as I suspect the legislature wanted it to. The standards themselves, although there were some challenges for facilities to get up to them, that it's a really good tool for them to say, okay, are we meeting this and what can we do creatively? And I was particularly impressed with some of the really creative and innovative ways that facilities are not just trying to meet these standards but exceed them and then share that learning with other facilities. However, as they have been able to address those smaller level items or consistency items, even more so there was things that stood out with needs for additional training, better staffing, more sustainable staffing, and in particular, physical plant challenges. This is really reflective of what our office is seeing and hearing about on a day-to-day basis as well in facilities. Minnesota's facilities, our prison facilities, have been under-resourced for decades, resulting in crumbling and unsafe facilities. There is an immediate need to dedicate resources to upgrade or replace facilities. We see this across the board at all facilities, but in particular, of course, our St. Cloud and Stillwater, which are both over 100 years old. And you know, we recognize that people are really doing the best they can in really challenging living and working conditions. And at some point, I think they need some additional support to figure out how to do this in a way that actually makes sense. The impact of those degraded conditions are challenging for both staff and incarcerated people. It's really tough to do your job well in less than ideal circumstances day after day after day, and even more difficult when that's where you live. Vulnerable incarcerated people particularly experience disproportionate challenges, and I think the commissioners talked pretty at length about the number of population that are aging, elder, disabled, have high medical needs. And when you're talking about challenging physical plant and challenging infrastructure issues, they are most vulnerable when we're addressing those. While there's some studies in place right now or in progress for two facilities, there's a deep need for a study and plan for all facilities to ensure that as a state we're preserving our investments and also providing healthier working and living conditions for staff and incarcerated people. I'm not going to get into each of these in depth, but I would love to connect and talk with anybody who would like to talk more about infrastructure challenges in particular. And I will stick around for questions at the end.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Members, next we're going to hear from corrections officers and programming staff. We do have four testifiers with us here today. We've got two who are here in person, so we'll begin with those and then move to the two who are here virtually. So I believe the two in person we have are Officer Jeff Bars and Officer Dan Gorman. You're both making your way to the table. Excellent. And Officer Bars, I have you on my list first. Are you all right? If you can please introduce yourself for the record and begin. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Good morning or good afternoon, Madam Chair, representatives. My name is Jeff Bars. I am the Corrections Policy President. This is basically the president of the correctional officers, the 2,000 correctional officers. I'm also a 23-year state employee, so I appreciate so much working for this great state. So the commissioner touched many things. I just want to hit a couple of them that have been very successful for us. I'd like to thank the work with our contract negotiations last year. We were in a staffing crisis. It's getting better. The forcing has gone down for the most part out of every institution. It's more volunteer. We do have some forcing on the times. Like the commissioner said, a lot of it comes from the transport, special duties, and other things that come up. I would also like to talk about the infrastructure. And the buildings are getting old. Things pop up all the time, whether it's radios or anything like that, and it does affect the programming and things like that. So if we can continue and have talks later on through the session and everything, that would be great. Staff wellness started out, what, a year and a half ago maybe with us, and it's still, to me, it seems like it's still in the infancy stages because getting a program going and getting it up, but I think there needs to be importance of that. I'll just use an example for me. I work at Oak Park Heights Correctional Facility. So since Wednesday of last week, we call them ICSs. That's when something happens in an institution. We've had over 100 of those since Wednesday. The past 2 days, we've had to stop programming because staff is so overwhelmed. And we need these resources to get the mind right and things like that. And that's from people responding to these calls, the health services, the other support staff, whether mental health, and also even the staff that are away from the scenes that might be listening to the radios or doing whatever else. It's just such a drain on us. So that staff wellness is very important. Dan's going to talk about the drugs that were coming in through the mail. I would like to point out that we had a little hiccup about 2 weeks ago, and we had a meeting with the commissioner and their people, and we were able to come around to get a resolve. It was overpayment when people were going. We had multiple people going out via ambulance in different calls, and it was a coding issue. And the commissioner and department administration sat down and worked that out very quickly, so I want to thank them for that. So other than that, we will be down here every week, the correction officers. So look forward to having talks with you guys, and if you want to reach out to Ethan Vogel at AFSCME, he can set aside other times if that need be. But thank you for your time, and I'll let Dan speak.
Wonderful. Thank you. And Dan Gorman, if you want to introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thanks. Absolutely. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the board. My name is Dan Gorman. I've been at Stillwater Correctional Facility for a little over 19 years now. So a lot of things I'm going to speak on today are going to be centered around the Stillwater facility. I don't want to call it my area of expertise, but It's where I've been for the last 19 years. Back in 2021, we started getting information that drugs were coming in through our mail system. We reached out to our administrations, asked for changes in our mail procedures, asked for something to curb this newfound way of getting drugs into our institution. We learned that you could go online and purchase synthetic marijuana, K2, legally and get it shipped in through the mail. So we asked for changes. A couple of those changes were deemed pilot programs. We started to see ion scanners enter into our institutions. And they worked a little bit, but I'm not a chemist or a scientist. If you change just the chemical composition of the drug just a little bit, these ion scanners do not detect the drugs that are on the paper. So one piece of paper that usually goes for about maybe less than a penny now was getting upwards of $30,000 in our institutions being sold by offenders to other offenders. When we found out that these ion scanners just weren't catching everything, they were catching some things. So then it was determined that some of our inmate population would then make up these false law agencies and send them in through our legal mail. We caught on to that. We started scanning them through for our legal mail as well, and started catching some of it, not all of it. We asked, something else needed to be done. Something better needed to be done, simply because we just were not catching what it was that was coming in. On a daily basis at Stillwater, there were anywhere from 2 to 3, like Jeff talked about, ICSs a day for inmates, for offenders who were under the influence. Sometimes upwards of 7 to 8 a day, averaging about 5 a day of offenders. And those were just the ones that we were catching, not the ones that were in their cells, doing their thing, going to sleep. Those are the ones that we were catching on a regular basis. In September, we had an incident at Stillwater where 9 staff came into contact with some sort of drug, unknown substance. We weren't sure what it was. And they ended up going to the hospital. Multiple others were checked out at the facility, determined that they were okay, and they could continue on their day. But 9 staff were sent to the hospital on that day. Officers, health service staff, via ambulance, they went to the hospital to be checked out. The problem is some of these things, we don't know what we're dealing with. We don't know what it is. When you change the chemical compositions, we've had times where the offender population would be combative. There are other times when they were just twitching and an inability to walk or any motor functions whatsoever, to vomiting, to even overdosing. So a lot of times when we had to deal with these situations, what would happen is we would have to shut down the entire cell block, have all the other inmates switch in so we could deal with this problem and make sure that the offender that was overdosing or on drugs would get the proper care that they needed. It was determined back in November of this year that we were going to start scanning the mail, start copying the mail. And I appreciate that, because we have gone from upwards of 5 a day on average to maybe 1 or 2 a week. It has been a night and day difference. I know there has been some pushback from listening to the media and some advocacy groups about, can we do this? Is this legal? I'm here today to ask that we continue this process. I know it does cost a little bit of money and there is funding involved for it, but this has made a night and day difference. It is safer for not only our staff, but our offender population as well. They don't have to deal with this any longer. It is very difficult now for them to get these synthetic drugs into our institutions because of the new procedures that have been implemented. So I want to say thank you and hope that we can continue this outside entity copying our mail and getting it sent in so we don't have any issues whatsoever with these drugs in our institutions. Thank you.
Thank you. And are you able to stick around for the rest of the hearing as well?
Yes.
Okay, great. And we do have two virtual testifiers. And just a reminder to those testifiers, please unmute yourself before you begin and state your name. And I believe we have Chrissy Gamst first. Welcome.
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee. Hi, my name is Chrissy Gamst. I'm a 20-year DOC employee. Currently working as a correction security caseworker in Moose Lake. I appreciate the opportunity you guys have given to testify before you as a representative of MAPE, so thank you for that. As a case manager in corrections, it's a role that can be best described as ever-evolving jack of all trades. We are security staff, social workers, counselors, liaisons to the court. We're the primary contacts for family members, law enforcement, ICE, BCA, the general public, victims of crime, and agents in our communities. We're the creator of the Lifer books, which are presented to the parole board and communities both in Minnesota and worldwide. I'm currently officed in a housing unit, as many case managers are. We're boots on the ground in the mix of all of our facilities. We work very closely with incarcerated individuals to work out plans for success, successful incarceration, as well as successful release through case planning, skill building, cognitive restructuring, restorative justice, education and employment opportunities, while advocating for the incarcerated person's needs and end result of successful release planning. Our goal is to send out a better prepared human into the world, all while addressing barriers related to trauma, mental health, lack of support, criminal thinking, a lot of lack of basic life skills that poses hurdles to success as well. I want to share that I'm a strong supporter of MRA and the other initiatives that that have been passed by this group and others that prepare and rebuild and heal our incarcerated folks. With that being said, we're struggling with the additional responsibilities that are required for them to come to fruition. Case managers and other MAPE staff are the primary program facilitators of the evidence-based programs that are creating a positive change in our populations. Some staff have caseloads that are 5 times the size of what a programming staff caseload should be. This not only affects well-being of our staff, but it also limits the extent of the work that we're able to accomplish in order to send out a healed and prepared human back into our communities. We all have a vested interest in our incarcerated individuals becoming contributing members of society. Again, thank you for the opportunity to be heard today. It means a lot. I'm confident that with the support of this committee, we can continue to transform lives for a safer Minnesota and make our communities both safer and more successful. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for being here with us. Next up, we have Ryan Patrick. If you can also introduce yourself and unmute first. Welcome to the committee. Yeah.
Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and board members. My name is Ryan Patrick. I am currently working as a clinical program therapist at the Department of Corrections in Moose Lake, and I've been here for about 16 years now. And I'm proud to be here testifying on behalf of MAPE, and thank you for your time. So today, I'd like to talk about the critical role that CPTs, clinical program therapists, play in corrections and highlight current challenges as we enter into a budget year. I'm currently in the SUD section, and we our program is called Paradigm. We offer multiple levels of care now, and that residential treatment clients spend an average of 6 to 7 months attending classes, completing amends, weekly thinking reports, and formulating relapse prevention plan, as well as developing skills for release. despite our efforts, I've noticed a trend of more clients fatally overdosing upon release. I know in years past, we've rarely had that happen. I could probably count the amount of people that we've lost on one hand. I don't know what the statistics are, but personally, people coming through our program, so we've seen that increase. We currently track opiate use disorder diagnoses and are providing medicine-assisted treatment options along with the release planning, and yet overdoses seem to be continually escalating. This also seems to coincide with the rise in the K2 and synthetic drug use within the facility, although this has been improving as well as was noted. These substances can be sprayed on any paper and distributed with minimal detection and are not discoverable through routine and urinalysis. We've had people overdosing, going out on hospital visits regularly and things like that from our treatment unit and facilities. This is also taxing on behavioral health because we have mental health therapists as well, and I can listen on the radio, and I know some of the therapists deal with very challenging behaviors. And whereas as a residential treatment therapist in the SUD section, our caseloads are capped at 12 individuals. Oftentimes, mental health, behavioral health have to cover an entire facility and deal with any day-to-day crises situations. And at times we've had just 2 to 3 behavioral health staff for the entire facility here at Moose Lake. So it's for these reasons that having adequate staffing of licensed professionals in addition to maintaining security staffing levels is necessary. In addition to working in a stressful environment, a lot of our facilities, especially in Moose Lake, Togo, CIP, are in rural or low population areas, and finding qualified candidates is very difficult. Job postings we've had close without having any qualified applicants or offers are accepted, and because of the additional training requirements of the DLC, people don't want to wait around for academy and things like that, and will accept other positions elsewhere. To address the shortage, one thing that we've done as a program, we've developed a paid internship program where people can come to the Department of Corrections and get their internships paid for, which as in our profession, oftentimes those are not paid positions, so it offers us a little advantage. But whereas when I started, we had people with a lot of experience and things like that, now we're having taking people in, training them who have no background in the field and are new to corrections. So right now we're currently short 2 residential counselors, and being fully staffed has been a rare luxury in my 16 years. This means that we are not able to offer treatment to 24 individuals while having to keep beds full on the unit, with many future clients having little structure. In the past, clients typically had to complete treatment to be eligible for work release and other early release programs, and lack of treatment staff is a huge bottleneck to their eligibility. I am also a supporter of MRRA and appreciate that. And one thing I've seen that has been a good addition is training client IPs here to be peer support specialists, and having peer support specialists connect with people in the community to help with release. But the lack of licensed professionals I could only see becoming a bigger issue as MRRA nears implementation and there will be a push to offer more treatment. And I know that we're not the only facility that has struggled with low staffing, and larger treatment programs. Challenge Incarceration Program, which is a boot camp out of Willow River. I know their CPT numbers have dipped into the 50% range, as has Triad, but I guess they're attempting to hire more people. There's a lot of competition throughout the state, and I don't feel that we've kept up with industry standards for hiring licensed professionals. Corrections poses challenges that require qualified personnel. We've seen efforts to hire security staff by improving wages, compensation, and legislative actions on recruitment and retention, but we have not seen these increases in our CPT positions. CPT positions often require a four-year college degree and a professional license. That is a big investment for people in our profession. Ensuring that the department has adequate funding for competitive compensation and benefits is essential in recruitment and retention of the personnel necessary to provide services clients need to be successful on release. It's a big investment to train at the DOC, and keeping people here should also be a top priority, and we hope that those of you returning to the community next session are committed to investing in us. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your testimony. And again, thank you to all four of those testifiers and for the work that you do. Appreciate it. Next up, we're going to talk to impacted people and local advocates and experts. And we're going to start with Alejandro Caceres Aranda. And then next will be Mancius Franco. If you want to also just come up to the testifier table so you're ready. And if you can introduce yourself for the committee and begin your testimony. And I'm so sorry if I mispronounced either of your names, so please correct me. Go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm just going to jump right in here. My name is Alejandro Caceres Aranda, and I'm a policy assistant with the Minnesota Justice Research Center. First of all, thank you for allowing me to speak today about the urgent need to address the aging and deteriorating conditions of Minnesota's correctional facilities, especially the St. Cloud Reformatory and Stillwater Prison. These facilities are not viable. Repairing would cost billions of dollars, and the current situation is not only unsafe, but also barrier to the kind of rehabilitation that can help reduce recidivism and improve public safety in Minnesota. Both St. Cloud, built in 1899, and Stillwater, built in 1914, are outdated and no longer fit for current use. The design of these facilities was abandoned decades ago because it creates significant safety risks. The narrow multi-tiered cell blocks make it difficult for staff to monitor the inmates or respond quickly to problems. The outdated infrastructure has also led to an increase in violence between inmates, especially in the recent hot summers where temperatures reached in the hundreds. Combined with the Stillwater facility that has no working air conditioners, this isn't only hard on inmates, but staff workers as well, as the folks who came up to testify mentioned. To make matters worse, these prisons are suffering from severe staffing shortages. The Department of Corrections has 211 vacancies, with 50 to 60 coming from Stillwater alone. This highlights the Department of Corrections' struggles to recruit staff in these deplorable working conditions. This contributes to lockdowns, increased tensions, and less time for inmates to engage in rehabilitative programming. The physical conditions in these facilities are also dangerous. Stillwater and St. Cloud have critical maintenance backlogs. The DOC's deferred maintenance totals over $700 million, with Stillwater needing more than $180 million, and St. Cloud needed over $154 million, just to bring them to fair condition. And the numbers keep rising. These are not just uncomfortable issues, they are health and safety concerns. Repairs alone aren't going to solve the problem. The Minnesota Justice Research Center is calling for a bipartisan legislative task force to examine the safety and viability of these two facilities and to look at the future of Minnesota's prison infrastructure. The problem at St. Cloud and Stillwater go beyond just the bad conditions listed. They're preventing the Department of Corrections from fulfilling its mission of rehabilitation and reintegration. Without the right infrastructure, Minnesota can truly transform lives for a safer state. Other states have already taken action by closing or renovating outdated prisons. In fact, between 2000 and 2022, 21 states closed at least one correctional facility, according to the Crime and Justice Institute. Minnesota must take similar steps and plan for a future where our prisons can support not just safety, but also the rehabilitation of incarcerated individuals. In summary, in my own personal time work with the Minnesota Justice Research Center, I've seen firsthand how bipartisan collaboration on criminal justice issues can work in a time where our political landscape is often polarized. At a recent forum with the Crime and Justice Institute, we were presented with examples of lawmakers from both sides of the aisle coming together in places like Nebraska, Utah, and Mississippi to discuss these issues and take action, build consensus. Recognizing that this is about public safety and fairness, not political division. Last year, the Minnesota Justice Research Center helped advise on House File 401A to create a task force to address these issues. We urge legislators to revisit this bill and move forward. Additionally, I urge this committee to listen to the other testifiers after me to hear their perspectives and personal lived experience. They have lived with these problems, and it's up to us to fix it. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you so much. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you very much. My name is Moncés Franco. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am a third-generation incarcerated adult. Myself, my father, and the uncle that raised him all experienced the incarceration system. My cousin Erica once said, "Yeah, you know how some families are a military family? Our family goes to prison." I learned who people wanted me to be before I ever had a concept of who I was. And in that environment, I wasn't afforded the opportunity to learn the pro-social things that I have come to know and love that make up the version of who I am today. Things like advocacy, volunteering, my own sense of community, and making a livable wage by doing meaningful work. My incarceration history starts at 14. I was certified as an adult at 17 and held stints of incarceration well into my 30s, where I spent 3.5 years between the Minnesota Correctional Facilities of St. Cloud, Moose Lake, and Lionel Lakes. I didn't like myself. I even hated myself at times. I had low self-esteem. I was a product of poverty, was raised around violence, and I developed a toolbox full of problem-solving skills that never fixed anything. I accept full responsibility for all of the harm that I created. I believe in accountability, and it has shaped me into the human being that you see before you today. I also believe in dignity and in dignified treatment and responses to all humans, including people in incarceration settings. In my journey with the incarceration system, I was not always met with dignity and learned early on not to ask anyone in carceral settings for anything, as the response always made me feel less than. I hold on to the stigmatizing experience for being segregated from general population, for being HIV positive, even with an undetectable status that science proves cannot be transmitted to others. Not that it could be passed in the air. This was a fear-based response that traumatized me. The incarceration system did not inspire my change. I was often witnessing or experiencing traumatization and re-traumatization by the conditions of incarceration settings. A blanket that didn't cover my body, lights on all the time, mold in the vents, 10 corrections officers lined up to take one individual to segregation for self-reporting of a mental health crisis. I sat behind two corrections officers where one badgered another, saying that he let an offender punk him, insinuating the way he was talked to wasn't allowed as a CO from an inmate. I watched the peer pressure wash over the second CO's face and him march over to where the inmate was. I don't know what he did or what he said as I put my head down, and I learned to mind my business in those ways. I didn't want to be in the line of fire. I saw the COs as human in that moment and subject to peer pressure just like me, capable of error and having room for improvement. Something about those things I listed are broken. I understand being broken as I was a broken person, but also I understand how it takes a plan, care, and accountability to repair anything that is broken. My silver lining was programming, particularly the power of people, POP. And as a pop guy, I was empowered to rewrite the narrative for myself. I went from being a person who hated himself to a person who carefully and delicately learned to love himself. At the Power of People, that was the first time in my 30-something years that someone took the time out to tell me I was lovable, valuable. Powerful and important. I never received those messages at home. The hope for change in me grew legs that day. Visitation and family support is so important. I didn't get many visits, but the visits I did get inspired me to continue to imagine and create those new narratives that I was writing for myself, narratives that hold the power to change generational patterns. I realize writing those new narratives start with me. However, I did not get to where I am alone. Lots of people poured into me. Some of those people didn't make it past the first barrier or the seventh. I carry those people with me. Degraded conditions are not dignity for incarcerated people. Degraded conditions do not inspire change. Degraded conditions do not reduce recidivism. Degraded conditions in carceral settings do not contribute to public safety. They make good people want to give up, in my experience. No child, like me, grows up wanting to be a criminal. Family and societal factors cannot be overlooked in that regard. But by the time they make it to a correctional setting, my hope is that they are greeted with an opportunity to hear a message similar to the one that inspired my change. You are lovable, valuable, powerful, important. Those messages can also be nonverbal. They can be in improved living conditions, community-based programming, access to visitation, and other plans to uphold the dignity of human beings who happen to be in a carceral setting. Everyone has value. There is no compromising that statement. I believe it is all of our duty to uphold that value, especially for the people that do not realize or who have become disconnected from their own sense of value. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to share my experience as it relates to the subject and for being open-minded to a dignified response for human beings in carceral settings.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Extremely powerful and valuable to our committee, and we appreciate you sharing your story with us. Are you both able to stick around for questions later as well? Okay, wonderful. Then I think since there are three seats up there, if the next three testifiers want to come up to the table, we've got Zeke Caligiuri, Kevin Reist, and Aaron Ernst. Oh, and also Mario Jackson, my apologies. There's four chairs, so you can all just come up and... I have Mr. Jackson on my list first, but whatever order you want to go in is fine as long as you just introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Chairman. This is a committee. My name is Zeke Caligiuri. I do community engagement work with the Minnesota Justice Research Center. I work with justice-impacted homecomers to help them reconfigure lives so they won't have to return to the actions and thinking that could return them to this ever-growing population of human beings. I do this work because I have lived in the cages managed by the DOC for over 22 years. I can speak to the difficulty it is to get out and be prepared to live as a healthy human being after the trauma of my incarceration. I came home and realized that even as I had done everything available to me to prepare me to return, it did not in any significant way prepare me for how the world has changed in the time I was gone. Yet we were expected to be transformed and healthy enough to process this new world. There's a wholesale dominance over the everyday lives of the people who live in these places. These places are administrated through a punitive culture of fear. You live every day hoping you won't be taken to segregation for anything that might get in the way of set goals and intentions. We don't have any agency in the ways these places are operated. As these testimonies seem to imply, the needs of the prison system are at their root centered around what staff needs. I am here to speak to some of the same things spoken of earlier in this hearing. I think we tend to ignore when we send people into these places just how hard it is to get through long bids of incarceration. We speak so much about the safety of staff within these places. I support the safety of people who are working in these places. But we've ignored the safety of the human beings who live in those places. Part of the expansion of the carceral landscape in Minnesota starting over 30 years ago means that our long-term population are now coming home and in their advanced age are looking for the opportunities to contribute to their families and the community structures that they come back to. They come out with a clear need to get the mental health and housing and employment support they need to be rehabilitated from the real effects of spending long periods of time in those institutions. I want to be clear. The system in policy and construction is a harmful system of dominance and abuse. Some of these facilities are so old. Stillwater is 110 years old. St. Cloud is over 130. The cost to put air conditioning in these units have been so prohibitive that it has never been done in the history of these facilities. There have already been instances that we know of denying showers and other resources during the hottest days of the year. We have to understand that even with deteriorating infrastructure, the people that are in charge of those facilities have to be humane in times of tension. 10 years ago, I sat in a cell as our captors celebrated Stillwater's 100th anniversary, as though 100 years of locking people into tiny spaces is worthy of celebration. We have not created a safer community or safer prisons. These places create injured and traumatized human beings who are going back into the world unprepared to be the parents they intend to be. I support the MRRA, but if we maintain the punitive structure of our discipline system and its corresponding restrictive housing issues, we won't get the kind of personal transformation we are hoping people will be able to develop in order to be successful as people returning to their community or as people living within the prison community. Use of restrictive housing has become more than just making safer facilities. It's been about controlling a population through fear and dominance. It's time to recognize a punitive culture that by its nature creates more tension and stressful interactions through its overuse of segregation or disciplinary housing that extends to a reliance on solitary confinement in an age when enough data has been produced and verified showing the adverse effects of keeping human beings in isolation for significant periods of time. We are not a community represented by a union. Even though our wages and financial control is managed and leveraged by people that have traditionally not even recognized us as human beings. We do not have legal protections or even representation, even though we are the ones in those places subjected to disciplinary action and procedure without the resources to protect us from the cruelties and disproportions of those facilities. We have built and repaired and rebuilt these prisons from the days the first ones were built in Minnesota, and our labor has never been recognized. Part of the wholesale dominance comes in the shape and material construction of a prison. The essence of it, though, is in the treatment of the human beings who live in them. It's time to consider whether some of these places still should be used, but also in who is administrating them. There is such a general disproportion of power that exists between admin and staff, and there's much greater of a gap between these two entities and with the captive population. To expect that admin and staff alone could ever remedy the dehumanization that has been created is ridiculous. We speak of understaffing. We support this. But it's not a recruitment issue. It's not the issue. It's just one of the untreatable symptoms of mass incarceration. We come here because we're asking you to listen. Please pay attention when we come to you about creating protections for us and our families to be able to visit without constantly having to tell children to be quiet or not move around, treating parents and grandparents as though they are criminals for wanting to see their loved ones, offering programming on parenting and expectation that the people in these places could be better parents, but you can't see the harm in constantly correcting human beings while they do the very real and human act of sitting in a visiting room with their families. It is our families and community that remind us of our humanity and connection to the real people and stories in these places. I will say one last thing. If you treat the people in these places like human beings, they will show a much more humane side of themselves. And that comes down to the spaces you put them in, but also the ways in which you govern. Thank you.
All right, sorry to follow. My name is Aaron Ernst. I have been in and out of the system for a number of years and come to see a lot of different things, just like Zeke and the others. So I'd say I'm an expert, kind of. But the thing I want to talk to you about is ending slavery in Minnesota. And that seems a little weird that we'd be talking about it in 2024. You know, I thought we were free, you know, growing up thinking that. And then I hear about the Emancipation Proclamation and all that, and I get excited. And I realized as I walked inside of prison and worked for like 25 cents an hour and got half of that, or maybe it was 50, I don't remember, that slavery is alive. It's alive and well. These human beings that are given numbers and dehumanized from the minute they walk inside of the gates have not only been ostracized and kicked out of the community for a period of time, but they're expected to rehabilitate themselves all the while being a slave. Their labor is stolen from them, and they are expected to have this as part of their sentence, although in my court order sending me to prison, it never said anything about you will also give away your labor, and you will also work for free, and things like that. I didn't see it, and I didn't see it on anybody else's sentencing sheet. So I don't understand why that is still a part of our sentencing structure or prison structure. Right now, I'm with an organization or with a campaign, which is a coalition of organizations, to end slavery in Minnesota. There's a legislative amendment sponsored by Senator Frazier, supported by so many of us, to really just tackle this for once and for all, you know, to take that clause out of our Minnesota Constitution. And what that does is it doesn't just restore some humanity to men and women who desperately need it. It also promotes and improves public safety. One of the major things that I see amongst myself and other people that have been incarcerated is this disconnection between us and the community. And the less I care about the community, the easier it is to victimize it. So when we start restoring people's humanity and when we start connecting them back to the community, we're actually improving the safety of the community, because now I feel like I'm part of it. Now I feel like I'm, you know, one of you, and that I'm accepted and that this is where I belong. I don't want to destroy my house. I don't want to tear down the foundations of, you know, my people and my community. And so that's just one thing. The other thing is also that when men and women in prison are, the slavery cause is taken out, those men and women become workers. They become workers who can then be paid a livable wage, or maybe minimum wage, or whatever it works out to be, but something that they can actually start to build and save and have something when they get out. They're able to have work history. They're able to then maybe even support their children through child support. They're able to pay taxes. And they can start doing that well before they are released. Well, that's big. That's important. That's also connecting us to the community. It's also building some of the skills that each and every one of the adults outside of the prison practice and strengthen every day. But most of us in prison that have been in maybe drugs or the criminal lifestyles, things like that, those type of responsibilities and that routine of, you know, paying your bills, the routine of paying taxes and things like that, I wasn't doing it, you know. And now that I'm out, I'm, you know, rebuilding those skills. And I was at a disadvantage when I came out. I hadn't been doing that for years. I hadn't been budgeting and really monitoring my money and things like that. I'd just been irresponsible and kind of had everything given to me while I was in the DOC as far as like my needs, but that skill was really missing. So this is an opportunity that we could grasp a hold of and really just have this eradicated. And I don't think we should miss it. Slavery was a disgusting part of our history. And to continue it, even if it's just with us criminals, is disgusting as well. So I'd like to say, end slavery in Minnesota.
Good afternoon. My name is Mario Jackson. I'm here. I do a lot of work with Zeke and Until We All Free with Kevin Reese. And so bear with me a little bit. My throat's a little sore today, but I just wanted to speak on
the Mr. Jackson, Medicare. Do you mind moving that mic just a little bit closer? Perfect. Yeah,
so,
thank you.
Yes, thank you. So I just wanted to speak a little bit about my experience as a kid coming to Minnesota from the south side of Chicago, who was looking for, you know, something different, right, and ended up in prison. While I was there, I spent 7 years over in St. Cloud, right, one of the more damaged prisons, right? And I remember going to SEG down in St. Cloud for going to church, right? Not being on the sign out list and things, right? But one of the experiences that I had and that I remained attached to, because what kept me anchored there so long, because they had the youth offender program there at that time, and I was a mentor for the youth offender program, right? And the thing that happened, like, that they changed me a lot more than I think I did anything to change them, right? But it was us being able to hold each other accountable. But what I noticed was just the amount of juveniles that was there that came through the system, right? And it was one of the things that always shook me to my core. I see some of those guys now, and this is 10 years after. I see some of those guys now. I see some of them went back to prison for very lengthy prison sentences and things like that. And so, there's really no way that I had seen there to, like, get through to them based on what was given there, right? The education was pretty much gone, right? I couldn't say, hey, let's go to these classes, make ourselves worthy of something better when we get out, because those was pretty much gone. They wasn't in the prisons no more. And then when you did get a job, you were paid almost less than nothing. I remember being in Lionel Lakes minimum facility where for 4 years I built homes, a lot of them from the ground up. Through that experience right there, and I remember making $1 an hour, right, and knowing what my labor was worth. And so I was able to get out, get a general contracting license. I see some city officials here who actually houses I remodeled for, right, as a general contractor. But it was like the road was so hard getting out, because even though I was building homes and going to work every day and doing it, I had no money to go home to. The canteen was so expensive, right? And it was like, so in order to survive here, I had to spend the little money I had. So the transition was a little more hard, right? You know, there wasn't too many programs that I was attached to. Luckily, I had Kevin and Zeke there. So when I did get out, when I was released, my reentry was a lot easier. I had people to actually work with that helped get me back into society and introduce me to just community work and being engaged, right? And so the one experience that I say I left with, more so like you were saying, with prison, with slavery, right, with prison being slavery, right, I wholeheartedly feel that now, right? I just remember, and I see even the guys that's going to come out now who's been there, and they're working in those they're working on those work crews and things like that in these counties, like over in cities like Edina. And I remember being in Minnetonka. And right now today, like I say, as a general contractor, I still can't go get a job in Minnetonka on that same city crew I was cutting grass with, right? So as a human being, think about how that feels, right? I was okay to cut grass for $1 in prison, but I can't come back and work in the city, right? And so I had to, me choosing the path of an entrepreneur, it was because of some of the barriers that was there when I returned home. Housing is still a barrier, right? I've been out for 6 years, and I'm just now finna move in my first house in my name and everything like that, just because the person I'm able to buy that, you know, get the house, rent the house from, was more like, you know, the background doesn't matter, right? And fortunately enough, it wasn't a slumlord to where I went to a place that, you know, should be condemned. Right. And so those are just, I just wanted to share a few of my experience. I didn't have anything prepared. I just wanted to share a little bit of my experience on, you know, what that transition was like. And because of how the structure of prison is, being able to go through there and educate myself how I did, work as hard as I did, and still be able to come home with nothing at the same time. Technology is here and everything. And then I was just so far behind the generation that I should have been with, because I was just there as another body in this place just being housed. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for your testimony and for sharing your experiences with us. And are the three of you able to stick around as well for the rest of the hearing? Okay, great. Next, we are going to move on to the section involving promising practices in corrections. First, we're going to hear from Dr. William Arbor from the University of Montreal. We'll then hear from the Department of Corrections and the Secretary of Public Safety of Oklahoma. So first up, we have Dr. Arbor, who's appearing virtually. So welcome to our committee. And if you can please unmute and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Absolutely. Before I start, does that sound all right?
It sounded a little muffled. Let's say something else.
Good afternoon.
Yep, we've got it. Thank you. Go ahead.
Perfect. Good afternoon, Sharon Moeller and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. William Arbour. I'm an assistant professor of economics at the University of Montreal. And today I want to provide an overview of research on reducing recidivism. I will draw from my own experience as an economist specializing in the economics of crime, as well as my work on evaluating interventions intended to rehabilitate offenders and lower rates of reoffenses. By way of background, I hold a PhD in economics from the University of Toronto. And my primary research interests lie in the economics of crime and applied econometrics. Much of my research draws on Canadian data, and especially from the provincial prisons, which house inmates for less than 2 years. Contrary to the popular belief, the Canadian and U.S. correctional systems share many similarities. For example, both countries struggle with persistently high recidivism rates. One key difference I want to highlight, though, is that community-based sentences are more frequent in Canada, meaning that those who end up incarcerated typically have committed more serious offenses. To truly determine whether a program lowers recidivism, we need to establish causality rather than relying on simple correlations. Randomized controlled trials, or RCTs, are usually the gold standard, but it can be difficult to implement in correctional settings. As a result, researchers often use advanced causal inference method to approximate RCT's conditions and to rigorously assess an intervention's true impact. The research I will be discussing today uses these causal inference approaches and thus meet the highest standards of scientific rigor. For the sake of time today, I won't go into the details behind the methodology, but I'd be happy to answer any questions, of course. Historically, a common refrain in North American corrections has been that nothing works to reduce recidivism. Yet, recent evidence can challenge this pessimism in the scientific literature. And we now know that certain targeted interventions can really make a difference. In particular, for today, I want to highlight two promising types of interventions: in-prison programming and parole practices. Programs offered in jails and prisons range from educational and vocational training to cognitive behavioral therapy, all intended to guide offenders towards successful reintegration into society. Now, despite the best intentions behind these initiatives, the literature has shown mixed results with no clear consensus on how these programs affect recidivism. And I must mention that there's limited evidence on their influence beyond reoffending on factors like health, earnings, and welfare dependency. That said, we do have some very encouraging examples that I want to highlight today. One such initiative is the IGNITE program, described in more detail in the blue box on the screen, which is now being implemented in several counties, including some in Minnesota. IGNITE offers tailored educational coursework based on the participants' educational levels, ranging from basic literacy and GED preparation to certifications in fields like food handling and commercial driving. The program operates 5 days a week and incorporates incentives such as access to tablets and the opportunity to participate in graduation ceremonies. The IGNITE program was first launched in 2020 in Flint, Michigan, and was and still supported by the National Sheriff's Association. We now have the results of the very first evaluation of the program. IGNITE has shown significant positive effects on reducing recidivism. Participants in the program are 26% less likely to reoffend within a year compared to non-participants. The Ignite program not only reduces recidivism, but also positively influences in-jail behavior. Participants in the program exhibit fewer infractions during their incarceration compared to non-participants. In Canada, similar rehabilitation programs focusing on violence, education, and employment have demonstrated promising results. An important aspect is that these programs are heavily targeted. Inmates are rigorously evaluated before being recommended for any types of programming. In a recent study, we evaluated the combined effects of these programs, and we found that participation, although it had no effect on rearrest, decreased the likelihood of reincarceration, which means that participants were less likely to commit violent offenses after participation. From a cost-benefit perspective, our conservative estimates indicate that for every $350, which is the average cost of these interventions per participant, translate into approximately $2,600 in savings due to reduced incarceration costs in the future. A select group of inmates can also participate in cognitive behavioral therapy. It targets high-risk offenders with low receptivity to treatment and focuses on addressing cognitive biases and pro-criminal attitudes. Given their relatively short sentences, the program is delivered over 24 hours of intervention in a group setting, and it focuses on three aspects of behavior: first, fostering personal responsibility, challenging distorted beliefs, and identifying behavioral triggers. The results are very encouraging. They indicate significant short-term reductions in recidivism, with a decrease of up to 16 percentage points within 6 months post-release. The key takeaway from this body of research is clear. Targeted programs, when rigorously implemented, can facilitate the rehabilitation of formerly incarcerated individuals. My own reading of the literature is that programs that facilitate a smooth transition with directly applicable skills, such as education, job training, and cognitive behavioral therapy, are partially effective. These interventions not only reduce recidivism, but also equip individuals with tools for long-term reintegration. A critical component in ensuring the smooth transition is the adoption of tailored parole practices. In Canada, the parole system is designed to facilitate a structured and a supervised transition from incarceration to reintegration into society. Parolees must respect a series of conditions, like abstaining from drugs and alcohol. However, the most important condition is staying in a halfway house. These facilities provide parolees with mental health counseling, substance abuse treatment, job preparation assistance, and other rehabilitative services. And while parolees in halfway houses are closely monitored, they are permitted to leave during the day for work, school, and other approved activities. And as you can see on the pictures on the screen, halfway houses are well integrated into communities, and they foster usually a very positive and supportive environment. In comparison to remaining incarcerated, we find that parole in a halfway house increases reincarceration rates among parolees, but at the same time generates a decrease in reoffenses, which might appear contradictory. The key here lies in how we measure recidivism. Parolees are often reincarcerated not because they commit new crimes, but due to technical violations of their parole conditions, such as missing curfew or failing a drug test. These violations are more likely to be detected because parolees are under closer and longer supervision than those who are fully released. However, it's important to emphasize that the presence of technical violations does not mean that parole is a failure. I suppose technical violations do not represent offenses. To address this issue of different supervision levels, in a recent study, we examined total time spent in prison as a more comprehensive outcome. Our finding shows that parolees, on average, spend about 4 fewer months in prison compared to those who serve their full sentences. Even though approximately 20% of parolees commit a technical violation that could lead to reincarceration, these violations do not outweigh the primary benefit of parole, which is to allow offenders to be released earlier. In other words, while technical violations may result in some parolees returning to custody, they are not significant enough to negate the overall reduction in incarceration time that parole provides. Halfway houses are likely an important mechanism for reducing technical violations. By providing access to rehabilitative programming, often continuing efforts that were started during the incarceration period, and by creating this structured environment, halfway houses may help parolees respect their conditions more effectively. To conclude, I'd like to highlight the key takeaways from today's discussion. First, tailored programming, such as education and job training or cognitive behavioral therapy, significantly reduces recidivism and improves reintegration outcomes. And second, while parole may lead to short-term increases in reincarceration due to technical violations, its long-term benefits, including reduced time and overall incarceration, remain clear. Thank you very much for your time and attention. If you have any further questions or would like to discuss the research in more detail, feel free to reach out to me, and I'm happy to answer questions at the end of the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Appreciate that. And if you can stick around if members have questions after the next two testifiers, we would appreciate it. Next up, we have Eddie Miles, the Assistant Commissioner for the DOC. Welcome to the committee. And if you can introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the members. I am DOC Assistant Commissioner Eddie Miles, and I'm here to talk about the trips to the state of Maine and what we've learned from their Department of Corrections. In recent years, Department of Corrections has been committed to identifying and implementing best practices by collaborating with other states. We've made a point of visiting and learning from operations of several states, including Montana, Missouri, and Maine. In June of 2024, Department of Corrections traveled to the state of Maine for an in-depth observation of how their correction agency operates. The DOC staff include executive team members, project managers, as well as representatives from MCF Faribault, including the warden, associate warden, captains, sergeants, and correction officers. These trips allowed us to explore new strategies and gain insights that we can bring back and enhance our operations. Let me tell you a bit about the Maine Department of Correction. Their mission is clear and focused on making communities safer. They achieve this by reducing harm through supportive interventions, empowering change, and ultimately restoring lives. Their approach emphasizes not just accountability, but rehabilitation and reintegration. The Maine Department of Correction operates with a strong set of core values, including accountability, respect, integrity, teamwork, and commitment. These values guide every decision they make and shape their culture and practices. Currently, Maine has seven state prisons housing a population of 1,675 individuals. Beyond incarceration, they also supervise 5,407 individuals within the community, demonstrating a comprehensive approach to corrections that extends beyond the walls of the prison system. One of the most remarkable aspects of Maine DOC is commitment to reducing the use of restrictive housing. In fact, they have the lowest percentage of individuals in restrictive housing in the entire country. This reflects their innovative strategies in rehabilitation and their dedication to improving outcomes for those in their care. Maine is focused on creating a culture of wellness that extends beyond punishment. Their goal is to rebuild and transform lives rather than simply serving time. The foundational practices to their work are normalization, humanization, and destigmatization. Excuse me. The Maine model of correction uses a privilege level system. The system provides incentives for pro-social behavior and incarcerated person active engagement and rehabilitative programs. Individuals who demonstrate pro-social behaviors and a commitment to personal growth are recognized and given additional privileges to reinforce those positive changes, choices. Some examples of positive behavior include participation in rehabilitative programming, maintaining positive behavior and attitude, pursuing education, and engaging in volunteer activities. And in response, the person is assigned a level that coincides with different privileges. These privileges include additional visits, increased recreational time, additional commissary, electronics, and more. A person's privilege level is evaluated at least every 6 months. There are more steps upward than downward. The Maine DOC also utilizes earned privilege units or honor units. The program was created with a work group of both Maine DOC staff and incarcerated people. The location of the honor units we visited was formerly a restrictive housing unit, a space typically associated with confinement, that has now been transformed into a rehabilitative space. Those who live in the honor units must be discipline-free for at least 5 years, agree to resolve conflicts respectfully, engage in work and volunteer opportunities from the unit, and maintain strong community involvement. These expectations create an environment where respect, personal responsibility, and engagement is at the forefront. Honor unit incentives includes being able to paint your own cell, buy items from Walmart once a month, go outside and garden, and much more. Staff conduct hourly rounds, but no staff are assigned to a permanent post within the unit, promoting autonomy amongst the residents. Incarcerated persons contribute to the unit by pooling their money to purchase items like a large screen TV, helping create a positive living space. They also work and volunteer outside their living quarters, playing an active role in the facility. The men in the unit meet weekly to discuss matters, taking turns facilitating the discussions, which builds leadership and communication skills. The honor unit also incorporates restorative justice practices, principles with IPs donating to local faith groups or victim organizations. And the data coming out of Maine speaks for itself. Weapon possession and assaults greatly declined, proving that this incentive structure is beneficial to both the population and the staff. Discipline incidents also are decreasing as well, and the number of people being able to achieve the highest level of incentives are staying consistent. So what were the key takeaways from the components of the Maine model of corrections? We understand that we will never be able to achieve the Scandinavian model of corrections as a state, but what we can do with the infrastructure that we have to keep staff and incarcerated population safe and successful, we're looking at ways we can create more incentives for the incarcerated population and move away from the discipline first. We're also considering a potential pilot of an honor unit at Incentive Faribault and put some of these ideas into practice. Thank you, Chair and the members, for the opportunity to present what we learned in Maine, and I'll stay around for questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And next we have Tricia Everest, the Secretary of Public Safety in Oklahoma, who is obviously joining us virtually. I'm sure she did not want to travel to Minnesota in December. If you can unmute yourself and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Tricia Everest, and I serve as, oh, there. Guys, you can see me. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can see and hear you. Welcome.
All right. I serve as Secretary of Public Safety for the state of Oklahoma, and it is a true privilege to be here, and I also have enjoyed being a part of listening to all of the speakers and presentations leading up to it. The justice system, in our opinion, and state nationwide, is just no longer sustainable, as it has always been run historically. When I first started this role, I would say that we nationwide warehouse individuals or policies and procedures with corrections were set up on a warehousing or babysitting, and that we worked hard in Oklahoma to make it workforce ready. That it's very difficult, as you've already heard, to hire police officers, detention officers, and that recognizing as the justice system needs to move forward, and I use very extreme terms, but if we need to get to where we only lock up those that are a danger to us, to other people. And I add as just an antidote, the number one predictor of violence on the street is also violence in the home. So if we elevate different things where there's violence in the home, we can go back to lethality against fatalities in our schools, in law enforcement. There's usually been a case of domestic violence somewhere before. So that's just kind of a side note. When we look at how we go from warehousing and how we can re-look at corrections, I really applaud the efforts that Minnesota has been doing and is working on in this public safety committee. I, as other speakers before, do appreciate the MRRA and look forward to its implementation into the plan as it develops next year. I want you to know that the legislative members in Oklahoma are not necessarily your typical friends. Oklahoma is an incredibly Republican red waving state, and our champions of all of our justice modernization are really individuals with economic development. They're not reformers. So we've really looked at it from an economically smart way. We know that companies and the industries need people, and in corrections, we just have people that need plans. So knowing that when we work with our chambers of commerce, we work at a whole of the pipeline where the governor was able to commute and have one of the largest commutations in his first year of really removing a number of kind of low-level, low-likely to recidivate individuals out. We work with both houses of our legislature, and we work with the chamber, our nonprofits, the think tanks to really come together. And in the last several years, we've closed 4 prisons in the state of Oklahoma by working together, all branches. As committees such as yours, early on, we would have a champion that would recognize no one was leaving prisons with the right IDs. They wouldn't have their driver's license or proper education. You know, our goal is it's once they leave, we don't want them to come back. So one of our representatives created the Sarah Stitt Act, named for our first lady. And when we're looking at having those identifications ready at the end and making sure that all of our corrections individuals would leave with IDs, it became acutely aware that that wasn't the time, like a company that shouldn't be waiting at the gate to receive the inmates coming out, that we started having transition fairs earlier, 6 months. I believe that part of your incentivizing the people in prison to be able to use their time better, to have less time in prison instead of how long, what do you want to do with your time? We wanted to take kind of one of your facets and was basically at the point of incarceration, we already start your plan of rehabilitation. So having the transition fair 6 months out before someone's release or even earlier, that one thing that we had lacked in Oklahoma at least, and probably I would say nationwide, is that it's not ever intentional. We have certain prisons do this, or education programs do this. We have laws, we have policies, we have rules, but they've never been intentionally brought together to address how do we work on that one person being able to get out and successfully not return. You all use the words transformational quite a bit, and I am a huge fan of that. We have one of the things that we have done is to try to change our culture from within. And all of our new vision statement is basically we change lives. We have it painted on our prison walls. We have it painted in every one of our admin buildings. We have it on all of the email codes. We have it on everything and to market it. And one of the reasons that we started to change the lives from the culture of the people who work in the prisons is so that the investment that you all make into your corrections, when you want to make an investment into your facilities, when you want to make an investment into the raises that you gave your Department of Corrections last year and otherwise, we in Oklahoma look at our legislative investment and we want to be able to match that too. And recognize that if we don't address the culture from within, then we don't have the people working all of these programs to be able to better prepare for those individuals to come out. So we wanted to have better individuals that worked within our centers. With all reinvestment and rehabilitation and all these ideas, there's always unintended barriers. And so in Oklahoma, we really started recognizing that coming out, we need to have that housing pipeline. We need to recognize what we can do with medical, mental health, and be able to bridge out. We want to remove fines and fees. Our judiciary has come on board, and if with incentivizing proper behavior and good behavior inside and then subsequently outside, the courts are now allowing and due to laws passed, the ability for someone's supervision on the outside to be readdressed through the court system as well as their fines and fees. You've heard testimony from individuals from within the pile up and inability to be able to succeed is such a launch pad. and your investment into the Department of Corrections and into these programs before they get in upstream and while they're in and help the corrections. I think you are well positioned to be that gold standard to move forward. As the Department of Corrections works to implement MRRA and incentivize the people in prison, I would also from Oklahoma kind of share that it's really good to be able to incentivize that person that leaves prisons too, that really look at what gradual sanctions would be, what different tailored individualized solutions. The more that we're able to individualize the process, you know, it goes back to, again, are we just warehousing people or can we make them workforce ready while still protecting our public? And looking at from the outside, we started having technology. You and I'm talking to you via Zoom. Like, this is fantastic. I can go through and maintain my entire day and my job and be able to have this privilege. We had, until recently, absolutely made every person that was under our parole for the Department of Corrections, you know, as I told the governor, go find a tricycle, go find somewhere, leave a decent paying job or a chance job, go get a urine test, and then take that bicycle because you can't drive, you don't have an ID, you don't have a car, and then have to do visual check-ins where someone is sitting across from a desk. I wouldn't be able to have the job that I have. Most people in this room I know would not be able to maintain if we were put under the same standards that, at least in Oklahoma, we did with our parole. So we have started to use more and more technology. We are now pushing towards where I can have a smartphone. I can check in right now if someone has it and says, yes, I'm with the great state of Minnesota, just like I said I would be, and they are able to check it back. So using more technology and incentivizing that, I mean, that will take an investment, obviously, of your legislature. But working and incentivizing that, the rollbacks of not having to have that rehabilitation, because every time someone comes back to prison, and I'm sure they've said it earlier, you're 10 times worse. I mean, if you, I went healthy the first time I was arrested. I really went healthy the 10th time I was arrested. And by the time I'm incarcerated, if I have any mental health, trauma, substance abuse, which 70% plus do, it's exasperated. And it just costs the state more and more money. So we're really trying to recognize that. We have instituted tablets in the last 2 years. So every one of our inmates has a tablet that they're able to use as a phoning device. I went through one of our prisons as just as an example of humanity. This kind of shocked me, and I've been working around for a while with the populations. A man was able to watch his child's first steps. Someone was able to watch the funeral of their mother. Someone was able to see their child graduate. And I had lost how much humanity it is that when we start being more intentional in the way that we serve others, that their likelihood of success on the outside and for the workers that work for the Department of Corrections, all lives improved, all quality of lives improved. So in addition to what you all did with the raises last year, we have raised money. We have created a wellness division as well and a wellness unit. I will say that it takes a long time to get street cred. It takes a long time for the generations of workers inside corrections to be able to trust the system that it's okay to have those check-ins and accountability. And so as we have generations of people that were trained on warehousing people and to not necessarily take care of themselves and have been working for probably not that much money, we've really centralized our training facilities. We have 23 prisons, and each of the 23 prisons until a couple of years ago before the governor selected a business individual to run the Department of Corrections and really change, do we change lives. If a certain prison needed to have staff, they would do their own academy, they would go train, they would recruit, and that person would come here. as we come to find out, I'm just going to, this is one of my favorite examples of how we intentionally, whether it's the legislative, executive branch, nonprofits, smart tanks, religious programs, departments all come together. When we closed one of our prisons in central Oklahoma, and closing four, it's been converted into a centralized academy. And so now what used to be housing units are now converted into dormitories for our recruits. They come and stay. We have one housing unit that is still a prison, or resembles as it did as a prison for training purposes. All their friends and family come in for graduations. All the wardens from every prison, all the leadership team now have dressed uniforms that they never had before. I mean, really instilling a sense of pride from coming from most prison staff had never met leadership and they didn't have clothes that even fit them. Now they have dress wear. As a cadet comes up on the stage, and our governor was the keynote speaker at our last cadet graduation, you have their picture of a cadet with the American flag standing behind them, a uniform that fits them. They walk off the stage and it looks like a bid day. And the warden of that prison that they're gonna go work to greets them, pats them on the back, sees their family and friends and says, we're so excited to have you. That change in accountability, that change in dignity, that change in recruitment and pride, we want to come together, just as I'm sure your Department of Corrections, that the more you invest into your corrections, the more that we will work together from statewide and individuals to be able to be the best stewards of that money. Lastly, I will say that I'm just going to add a side note. Our prisons are generally, with the exception I just described, in very rural Oklahoma. We closed one that had needed a tremendous maintenance, but yet we really also didn't need the prison because we had been investing in really modernizing our justice system, creating a workforce, being intentional. So we were able to lower our populations and close prisons. Legislatively, it's not very popular because you're closing a prison or an economic driver in a certain area. So I just remind people, we want to close prisons, plan on that economic driver, or please invest in the ones and fix up the ones that you really do want to keep, because that's necessary. Again, it's been a privilege to share a little bit of what we're doing in Oklahoma, and I look forward to being available to all colleagues in Minnesota.
Thank you, Secretary Everest, and thank you again for being here for the three testifiers we just had as well. And I know I had the opportunity to hear you, Secretary Everest, at a conference that I attended. Actually, it was either you or Governor Stitt that said, you know, you realized you have this Department of Corrections, it's called Department of Corrections, and you weren't actually doing anything to correct behavior. And so really appreciate all the efforts that you've made in Oklahoma and sharing those with us today. And that is it for our testifiers. So we will move now to committee discussion. And so I think what we'll do is, depending on the questions, whoever's coming up to the table will, so that we're not having a rotating door of people. If you have, for example, Commissioner Schnell, I'm seeing a head nod. So why don't we have Commissioner Schnell come up first. And then if anyone has questions for the commissioner, we'll begin with those. And Lead Novotny, do you have a question now? Okay. Oh, Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's good to be back. Thank you, Commissioner Schnell. And I think today we heard a lot of experts, a lot of testifiers who have been incarcerated that shared their stories. And I think that they all expressed a real potential here for us to achieve reform and true reform, something that's meaningful. But a word that I heard three or four times today was humanize. We need to humanize each other. And one of the issues that I see in some recruitment and retention issues, I'll share a story here with you. Representing Lionel Lakes, I run into a lot of COs, whether it's at the local bar, Trapper's Bar and Grill, it's a great spot. I'll be sitting down and all of a sudden there's a group of them and I get the opportunity to talk with them. And I say, well, how's it going? How are things looking at work? And they say, not great. They don't feel as if they're being represented by DOC leadership. And not only that, they actually feel as if they're almost treated with an adversarial form of leadership from the DOC. And when I ask them, well, what do you mean by that? Can you give me a for instance? They brought up a particular one that stuck with me, and I needed to do some research on it afterwards. Looks like on April 10th of 2023, you appeared as a guest on a podcast. It's called I Got Something to Say, and the podcast host and creator was found guilty of two counts of promoting prostitution of two underage girls. And I'm all for having, you know, dialogues and, you know, crossing those boundaries with anybody. But in that podcast, you have a case where you guys are discussing and shared a chuckle over two corrections officers who were assaulted. How is that a humanizing approach? And how is that impacting our recruitment and retention here? Because it seems as if this is a cultural issue, not just a monetary issue. There's a lot of folks who aren't wanting to engage or become a CEO because they don't feel as if leadership has their back. Can you talk to me about that a little bit?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Egan, I appreciate the chance to address this directly. First and foremost, I think as evidenced by some of the people you heard from today, we need to be in a position where we talk and engage with anybody and everybody. And humanizing people means that you humanize and engage with people who have been involved in their past, things that were utterly unacceptable. And the person who had that podcast, that I was encouraged to participate in this from one of the county attorneys who had appeared on this podcast and encouraged me to join him in a conversation. That's what I did. It was never looked at in terms of anything more than talking about the issues that were critically important. As to the issue of chuckle, that was never a part of it. In fact, I didn't know that there was anything related to a staff assault prior to talking with him. And yet, at the same time, while that conduct as well was utterly unacceptable, it does not and should not stop us from engaging with people who've done things that we don't respect, we don't like, and that are contrary to our values and our interests. So while on the one hand, I understand, and I've had many conversations with both union members and staff about my involvement in that conversation in this podcast, the reality is these are difficult cases and difficult situations. And yet, if we want to humanize people, we're going to engage with them no matter what. And the intent of that conversation, which unfortunately was not presented in the way that I would have wanted him to present it. But the purpose of that conversation was to humanize and talk about the important work that needs to happen if we want to create safer communities and re-engage people in ways that are meaningful. That's the purpose of that conversation.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you for that. I would just suggest that we also humanize the corrections officers, who are boots on the ground, the experts who are dealing with this every single day. And you cited the numbers. There's increased harassments. There's increased assaults. These guys are going through a lot, and they deserve a hell of a lot more on the monetary side than we're currently doing. So I would just suggest that we also bring that approach to the table. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Egan, I also appreciate that. And I think we have made really pronounced efforts to one, you know, grow the efforts around recruitment and retention, compensation, and even the wellness efforts. And I think while labor management issues are always going to be a factor, I'm proud of the fact that, you know, we engage and we have differences of opinion and disagreement. But at the end of the day, it serves no one, and it serves certainly not the corrections officers. It does not serve our mission when we don't deal with and continually address issues of concern on a labor management perspective, and that's the goal. And I think, you know, I think President Vars raised one of the examples that we were able to work through that was a real and concrete issue of critical importance for our staff related to those who were exposed. And in working with the Department of Admin, and when that issue got raised, we were able to address it. And you know, I have said repeatedly, I am so immensely proud of the work these people do around the clock and in the most challenging of environments. And I don't know how else I can say that more clearly than the pride I feel for that work that gets done every day. And I'll say that again, but I have made that message also a priority along with efforts around reformation.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Couple questions. First question, so we had talked, you mentioned earlier, Commissioner, about the cost of copying mail, because that was a response to increased drugs when making their way into prisons. And so just sort of go back and address that cost, I'm curious. We know that the cost of medical care for exposure to these drugs is probably pretty expensive too. So I'm curious if you have any ballpark idea of the reduction in costs from copying mail, the reduction in cost of medical issues compared to, you know, the increased cost of copying, and if that sort of offsets each other, if there's cost savings, you know, that kind of thing.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a great question. And when we, in fact, talked with Text Behind, the company, that the organization that provides these services to the DOC here and to our neighbors to the east, the Wisconsin DOC uses them, and a number of states and large jails around the country use them, that in fact, when factoring all of the cash costs of scanning and managing mail, or doing infrastructure improvements to manage things like negative pressure rooms or venting systems, all those types of things that come at significant cost, that just on an operational level, that at the end of the day, using services like Text Behind, who is set up for these types of services and business, actually reduces cost. And I think, you know, I think as was pointed out by President Vars and President Gorman, that, you know, this stuff has meant a lot to staff. We are committed to continuing doing this because I think it does make a difference for safety and really helps us in a number of other ways. And more importantly, it allows our staff who are spending a lot of time simply trying to manage the copying and of this mail to now really being able to focus on the work that keeps them and their partners safe and provides and ensures that we can provide the kinds of services and supports that are going to reduce recidivism in the long haul.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for that. Good to know, and I'm glad, you know, there's eyes on that. And I agree. I think the more systems that we're able to implement on the front end for safety is going to have a significant cost savings in the end. My next question for you has to do with, you know, there's a lot of conversation today about rehabilitation versus punitive measures. We had visitors from across the nation just sort of bringing that message home that these warehouse-type institutionalized places where nobody really feels human, that we need to do more work to humanize that, do more rehabilitation and giving people, you know, resources that they'll need when they're back out, right? And we don't want them to come back. That's the whole point. So given all of that around that conversation, do Minnesota's facilities currently allow for the department's desire to have these programming needs fulfilled? Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, yeah, I think one of the things that we're excited about, it's not going to be without challenges, but as we look at the changes that we've initiated over the last several years, and that really starts with, and I think as Secretary Evers talked about, really making sure that we're targeting and addressing the needs of that at the individual level. And so one of the things that has been a significant change, which may not seem like a significant change to some, but when people come into our system today, we're focused on a person-centered approach that has them having a significant voice in what that program should look like, in what it is that, that they feel they need, along with looking at the data, the assessment data, to develop a plan that's going to help guide them through. We know that there are going to be, that there are challenges with the range of issues of people's needs. For instance, substance use disorder treatment, as I mentioned, at any given time, 1,000 or more people in substance use disorder treatment, and yet 70% of our population has that need. So one of the things that I really appreciate is that our health services and our treatment staff have really looked to match treatment services and treatment interventions with true assessed need. And so that what ends up happening is we are now providing treatment at varying levels across our system, and that's helped. Now, to be clear, and as we heard from the testimony earlier, looking at licensed staff and our challenges around recruiting licensed therapists and chemical dependency treatment folks has been a challenge, and especially in some of our more rural communities, that has been an issue. We have been having, and Assistant Commissioner Robertus is here today, having conversations about the ways that we try to develop opportunities for even our staff who currently work for us to participate in programmings that the state may look to provide to grow therapists and treatment folks within our agencies, because we realize that it's going to be difficult in the long haul. And so we want to be as creative as we can to try and address those needs, but we feel confident that we have to start someplace. If we were going to wait to have a system that could meet the needs of everyone before we started to talk about how it is that we incent people to do well, we will never get there. We had to start from a position of saying, let's create the framework to allow people to demonstrate and show their commitment to change. And we believe that in concert with the folks that we have heard from, whether it's families of incarcerated people, formerly incarcerated, some of them actually here today, that we know that this can and will make a difference. It's not coming as quickly as people would like it to, and yet we feel it's critically important that people have some trust in this process and system, and that when all is said and done, that we can feel like we get it in a meaningful way that supports the kind of change and outcomes that we all want as Minnesotans and having safer communities.
All right, members, we have four members with questions for Commissioner Schnell, and then we'll move on to any of the other testifiers if you have questions. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Schnell, for being here. I have a specific question to ask them, and then just one general inquiry. So I was looking back at my notes, and yes, members, I continue to do that. The member from, or the worker from Moose Lake, he talked about the difficulties it was to find qualified candidates for the CPT programs. And one of the reasons is because there is additional training that they have to do. And I just wanted to know specifically what that is and why would it, because, you know, as we're trying to find people, I just wanted to know what specifically is added on to what maybe has already been done. I mean, if they're graduating with a four-year degree, what is some extra training that we believe is most necessary that's actually preventing them from coming?
Yeah. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's, I think, a very legitimate and good question. I think, you know, what we are looking for is that the basic licensure skill base to provide whatever service that is, whether it's substance use disorder treatment or whether that would happen to be like more mental health-based therapeutic services. But beyond that, the one of the things that oftentimes is required that is a little different is I may go to work in a hospital, as a for instance, and I will have to learn certain procedures and protocols. But coming into a prison setting can be quite extensive by way of the types of training that people have to participate in. And while I may be hired as a therapist in one of the facilities, when all is said and down, done, and at the end of the day, when the need is there, and one of the things that I think I hear from staff all the time that people feel good about is that people come together and address problems, whether that's feeding people, if that's what's needed, or responding to an emergency or a need of a staff member or an incarcerated person. This is when people come together. And so that's the kind of training, I think, that is oftentimes talked about. And, you know, again, these are not easy environments to work in.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I just wanted to know if there was some specific, like a Minnesota testing type thing that we were looking for, but because sometimes we can specialize ourselves out of a job, and that's not something that we are interested in. The last thing, or my general inquiry, was I had the immense privilege of touring almost all of your facilities, not this past summer, but the summer before. And it was, I really, really enjoyed looking at the facilities and seeing exactly what we're talking about with degrading infrastructure. And one of my most favorite, if I can say that, tours was at Shakopee. I really enjoyed seeing how your staff interacted with the women and just the life-changing testimonies that I heard there. One of the questions that the senator, Senator Grunhagen, asked was the recent transfer of a transgender female there. And the warden at that time kind of laughed it off and said it was the most uneventful thing he'd ever seen in his life. I have an article that says that there's now up to 5 or 6 of these inmates who are transgender. And several anonymous women are talking about how uncomfortable they are having fully intact males in a woman's prison. I wanted to know, what is the status of this? What is happening with this? I wanted to know, how are women being able, biological women, able to feel safe as they are doing the rehabilitative process that they need to do, when we are getting reports of high anxiety, high discomfort, and the feeling of unsafety? So if you could just give me some sort of status of what's going on and what the DOC is hoping to do about that.
I'm actually not going to turn it over to Commissioner right now for that, because I don't know what anonymous source that you're referring to. And we need to keep moving. We have multiple people on the list. We'll have Commissioner Schnell back. You can talk to him anytime about this. I'm sure the committee will have him back at some point. But we're not going to go into that discussion right now. Next up, we have Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, I want to tell you, I'm moving on this Public Safety Committee to other committees in the next session. And I want to tell you, it's been great working with you. Your transparency, when I've had questions, when labor has come to me, I have to tell you, it's like really different now. And I know that there's still opportunities with labor, but they really amuse me. And I could tell you, I'm going to pick on Representative England here. I want you to go on my podcast, because I want the people of Minnesota, it's only 20 listeners, but anyways, the people of Minnesota really have to know what's going on in the prisons as far as infrastructure. And the investment that we are really looking at, pay me now or pay me later. And I know you, it's like talking to the choir here, but as I move on and go on to different committees such as taxes and stuff, I see this as being one of our, this is just as important as our freeways. And your workers, Moose Lake, is that our newest prison? Is that right?
Rush City.
Rush City, I'm sorry. And the complicated problems. I mean, the low bidder, I don't know what it was, but you inherited these problems and you're doing the best you can. But what, I missed your presentation. I don't know how much you hit on that, but is this some, it keeps me up at night. I'm wondering if it does the same to you.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, this is a huge challenge. I think everybody has spoken to this, whether it was folks who were formerly incarcerated to AFSCME partners, everybody, I think, recognizes this as a reality and an issue that we have to address. And I think, you know, when all is said and done, how is it that, you know, we put people, human beings, in these facilities, and we want them to thrive? We want them to be in a position where when they come out, They're contributors. They're our neighbors. They're good consumers. They're good parents. That's what we all want. And it becomes really difficult to do the work in these facilities for staff. And it becomes, I can't even imagine what it would like to live in some of these facilities under the circumstances. And I think it's one of the things, as I was listening to Secretary Everest, and I think as we think about what opportunities may exist with MRA, how do we think about what we want our prison system in this state to be? What is good stewardship of resources when it comes to the investments we make in these facilities? And do we continue to throw good money after bad by investing in upkeep of 110, 120-year-old buildings? These are, I think, bona fide, legitimate questions that speak and tie directly to the question and issue of good criminal justice policy, that bonding and our facilities and our infrastructure is connected. But I was struck by Secretary Everest's kind of comments around the investments that they've made, and at the same time some of the reductions that they've made in their facility footprints. And I think it is a bona fide and worthwhile conversation for us to have.
Thank you.
Representative Whitty.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Mueller, for those treats also. And thank you for your time here, Commissioner. There is a lot that I would like to cover, but I'm going to really just focus on the correctional officer safety. I appreciate that you've talked about the investment and what you did. I believe it was this summer when you had a correctional officer assaulted by an inmate with caramel thrown on him and or on her. And I first asked the question, how she's doing physically and emotionally.
Commissioner.
Just generally at a high level, just not to get it to do it, but fortunately she is back and I think doing as well as can be expected, but doing well.
Thank you.
Whitty.
Thank you, Chair. I did go out there more to do the check the welfare to see how it was. And because you didn't see much in the news, we hadn't gotten any information back. Going out there, we didn't get in contact with anybody. I know you did call later. We did try checking in with the warden. I guess my question when I got out there, I learned about the drugs. And I guess I'm more concerned about if that was the root cause, because she got pulled back for her own safety, which I think was smart on the group, and she went out on her own for doing her job, preventing these drugs from getting into the facility. Why did it take so long to finally get this addressed? And then having 10 officers one day and then two the other day, why wasn't the BCA contact if we didn't know what the substance was, to kind of work or investigate another great state agency? Why aren't we working together on that?
Yeah, before I turn it over, I'll just say we're getting into some very specific situations, and I was really hoping for this hearing to really talk about sort of short-term and long-term solutions. And I don't know all the details of the incident that you're talking about. It's very in the weeds, and I'll turn it over to the commissioner, but if you can keep your answer brief, because we do have a number of members on the list still.
Madam Chair, thank you. I would just say that we have had conversations with the BCA along, and they did some testing work for us of these substances. We knew and were aware that some of the stuff, as was testified to by others, that it was synthetic narcotics, and that the compounds change on a regular basis. We had purchased a variety of technology that was deployed. And that became the issue. The challenge is really how do you close the dike, so to speak, plug the dike around the introduction of this stuff. And we know that while the mail was one of the major concerns, and I think we were trying a variety of efforts, including having staff do the copying and now getting to where we are. But along the way, I think we also know that and I think everyone will agree that we're going to face other challenges. We have people who are bringing it in through visiting. There are any number of ways that this stuff can be introduced, and it is the nature of the work. And so I think we have had, and I will also tell you that there has been some cases that have been prosecuted that we have spoken to and that have been in the media where it's been staff cases. There's also been cases that we've investigated of people on the outside who have been conspiring to bring drugs in. And we have a number of very active investigations that are currently ongoing. So we are working with partners both locally and federally.
Representative Woody.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate your answers. I know Officer Gorman said that it has reduced going to where you're at. For me, it's life or death, not just for the corrections officers, but also the inmates. You've had overdoses and that. So I'm glad it's addressed. I'm glad we're moving forward. And I look forward to hearing about more of the information on that. Thank you. Thank you for the time.
Yeah, and that just sparked a question I had, too, about the use of the tablets when you have those. Do you anticipate some of the mail going that way or through the use of the tablets kind of also further decreasing way things could be coming into the facilities, Commissioner?
Madam Chair, thank you. That's a great question. Yes, the even text behind oftentimes works with tablet providers. So when tablets are fully deployed, the people can have mail come get sent in directly, scanned into that individual's tablet, and they have the ability then to even respond at no cost. An incarcerated person can respond to that person at no cost.
Okay, thanks. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Snell, for being here today. Just like my friend Hewitt, I'm rolling off this committee too, so. But I'll try to find ways to stay connected. My question goes, I don't think this is something you spoke about, but it's something that I've been thinking about and it's been in the news. In your annual reports, you found some violations in a juvenile detention center in Hennepin County. And I bring this up because I always say that accountability has its place, but it's the then what, and it's the then what that I think we always struggle with as a society, not just here in Minnesota, but as a society. And my question revolves around, with our young folks, I'm always looking for a way, how do we get upstream and stop things so we don't have the future problems that's the reason that we still need to have prisons today? So what's being done accountability-wise to make sure that those violations that you found, this is around having young people locked up and isolated for longer periods than they should be, and so we know can lead to harm, which could then lead to further things down the line, trauma being brought back out to the community, that trauma being then inflicted on the community because hurt people hurt people. What are we doing to ensure that accountability will be in place there to ensure that these things don't continue to happen?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Frazier, I think these have been big changes that were enacted by the legislature going back a number of years now with the Hardell-Sherrill Act that impacts both primarily adult facilities, but also these youth facilities and detention centers that are licensed. I think first and foremost, one of the things that we have spent a lot of time with, and I think Representative Pinto did a ton of work as it related to the whole policy changes around the use of disciplinary room time and so forth. And one of the things that I think we can feel a level of pride about, again, we haven't fixed all the problems, as you point out. But one of the things that I think has been remarkable is that the detention centers have youth serving facilities have come together and really worked collectively to try and find answers to issues around disciplinary room time. Now, the issues that have arisen in some locations, and one that you point out, has been, you know, staffing related issues that ultimately are driving the length of time that youth are kept in their own cells, for lack of a better word, and oftentimes that can hit, when there isn't school going on or other programming, that can hit 22 hours in a day. And that's just simply too much. And so, you know, what we have implemented is are using the authority of the agency to direct change orders be put in place, and that is the precursor to what could become action related to licensure. And now licensure actions are more challenging when it comes to juvenile facilities because they weren't included in some of the authority that was granted to us in Hardell-Sherrill. But nonetheless, we are hearing loud and clear and have heard from Hennepin County and really all of the places where some of these actions have taken place, that there is a full-scale commitment to making sure that they get to an appropriate place around providing services to, in this case, youth. And our inspection and enforcement unit will continue to monitor that, report on that, and as needed, take action up to and including action related to the license.
Anything else?
Yes.
Oh, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Commissioner.
And actually, I'll just say this too. Does anyone have any questions for Christy Gomps? She's the case manager for Moose Lake. She has to leave, so I just want to make sure that she's free to go. All right. Thank you so much, Christy, for being here. It looks like we don't have any questions for you. She was on virtually. Go ahead, Representative Frazier.
Quick follow-up. So with the with Hennepin County giving their assurances that they're implementing something to make sure this doesn't continue to happen, how frequently will those follow-ups be from DOC to ensure that that is the case? Because I know this was found in an annual report. I just want to make sure we're checking in more frequently than that to ensure that we're on the right track.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Frazier, as part of the correction order, that there is a reporting process where they report and our inspector staff who are assigned are in fairly regular contact around what's been identified as challenges, and they have been and will continue to regularly report on their progress.
Just one.
Representative Frazier.
Is that monthly, quarterly? Do you have any?
Madam Chair, I don't know exactly, but I can tell you that right now it's weekly and a very regular basis they're having communications.
Thank you. The one option I didn't give. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Representative Pinto, don't forget to unmute, please.
I'm had to unmute both the sound and the video. There we go. Thanks, Chair, for putting this together, and Commissioner and everybody who testified, the folks who I've been formerly incarcerated, I guess I found just especially powerful. I really appreciate you sharing your experience. I wanted to just make a comment, kind of responding to an earlier comment from a colleague on the committee regarding the support for correctional officers. And just to remind us, and it feels like a really good time since we're ending the one term and about to transition to another, just for the committee to step back and really appreciate and recognize the incredible work we all did together and did in particular on behalf of correctional officers who are doing this incredibly important job and the historic increases in wages, significant increases. Of course, there's so much more that we need to do, but I really appreciated hearing at various points, kind of recognizing, you know, hey, things are getting better in a given area. Recognizing that was because of the work that we did together. And there's a lot more to do, but I think we can be really proud of the support that we've provided thus far for corrections officers, and especially over the last 2 years working together. And then I guess just want to encourage all of us. There's a lot that the agency can do and that folks involved can do, but I just keep on hearing kind of physical infrastructure pieces that just have to have the legislature going through the process and allocating pretty significant funds. And I'll just note for each of us, I'm thinking about this for myself, there may be a bonding project that I'm particularly interested in my district or you're interested in your district. And I think kind of naturally in the process, the investments that are going to be needed to really achieve our goals are going to require those of us on this committee, especially those who are currently on and even those of you rolling off, we need you too, to be making the call to our colleagues in the Capital Investment Committee. So I just kind of want to call that out while we're focused this afternoon. And maybe, Chair, that was a little bit of your thought as well, pulling this together. But thanks so much.
And the last I had was Representative Novotny.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair Waller. Commissioner Snell, I was going to start out. First of all, we had 97% staffing rate that we have right now. How does that translate to actual numbers on line staff? How many line staff are we missing?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Novotny, Lee Novotny, I don't know exactly what that number is. One of the things that is, you know, and especially in large agencies, you know, there is so much transition just with retirements and so forth. So we will never, ever be in a place where we're fully, fully staffed. 97-98% is really how we budget. We budget at 97%, so a 3% vacancy rate is the budgeting factor simply because of the rate of turnover. But I think we are in a really exceptional place that we have that across the agency, especially among the CO ranks. And yet, I think we've all highlighted some of the challenges that we continue to face.
Lee Novotny.
Chair Moeller, Commissioner Snell, so one of the problems that we've had in the past was the high amount of overtime, both the cost in dollars and this wear and tear on the staff, which contributes then to people quitting, which contributes to it's a snowballing effect. Has the overtime gone down with our staffing levels from the past?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Lee Novotny, yes. I think we certainly still have overtime, and we still have overtime costs that are higher than we would like them to be. At the same time, we have to meet the needs. The good news is, and I think as President Vars talked about, that fortunately we have less forced overtime, which was really the driving factor around people leaving.
Representative Woody.
Chair Moeller.
Lee Novotny.
Commissioner Snell, going to the scanned mail. It's a pretty substantial contract. I read somewhere it's approximately $500,000. What was the exact cost of the contract? And going forward, will there be an opportunity for a local group to bid on that? We don't know anything about how the original contract was set up with the text group, text behind it, I believe it's called. Will there be opportunity for a local group to do that and save the mail and the time and the opportunity for mail to get lost and things like that?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Lee Novotny, yes. The contract that we did was an emergency contract, which is provided for because of the circumstances. And I think just given what was happening to staff and those sorts of issues, we felt it was incumbent upon us to act as quickly as possible, which to be able to work with Text Behind to put this in place, they had the infrastructure to do it. And as I mentioned, are serving Wisconsin and have been almost under similar circumstances and started on an emergency basis and then now has been 3 years. That said, our contract, it goes for 1 year and 1 year only, and we would need to go out for an RFP. Key and I think the bigger challenge for a lot of local companies, and if there is one, I'd love to see them come forward, but it's the infrastructure to safely process this mail with PPE and hood and venting equipment that's necessary. But we would love to see that, but the contract is 1 year and it was done on an emergency basis.
And Lee Novotny, we're hearing from people online, they can't hear you. I don't know, your mic is right there, so I don't know if it's on, if it's, all right, so go ahead. I feel like it's not.
Can you hear me now?
Maybe try. Yeah, we can hear you and hear fine, but I think I'm not hearing that it's the mic is on.
Thank you. Moving on. Commissioner Snell, last my place here. Oh, as part of the security review group that I sit on, we talked last week about the body-worn cameras and bunnies out there finding out that it's a pretty slow deployment, or it's not a full deployment yet. And I'll have a follow-up question and just answer it at the same time if you can. It revealed in that security review that, and just tell me if I understood it right, that Oak Park Heights, our maximum security prison, is not slated to get body-worn cameras?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Lee Novotny, first, I think, as it relates to the deployment and implementation, as you know, and probably recall from our law enforcement days, that when they first started, implementation took some time, in part for the creation and the development of policies, some of the conversations that we had with labor, the procurement process of purchasing, and then just installation of things like the cabling to upload video and so forth is all in place. During the conversations with the legislature, when the body camera pilot was initially approved, the specific facilities that were named in that or discussed in that was Shakopee and Stillwater. We were able to, because of just some of the ways in which now the cameras are able to be no longer just assigned to a single person, but can be shared across staff, we were able to expand that somewhat. And so Lino was included in that. But Oak Park Heights is not, at this time, part of that project.
Lee Nabotny.
Thank you. We'll have to address that going forward. Last line of question that I have for you, I'm sure the rest of the active representatives like myself are receiving emails right now about the implementation of the MRRA. Families are questioning the timeline, and they saw the timeline that you posted about how that implementation is going. Was there some misunderstanding on what was communicated to the families about when MRRA would be starting? What are the obstacles? Are we on the timeline that was expected or not? And, if there wasn't, was that communicated? Because there's a lot of heartbreak and emails that we're getting because this is not being implemented when some of the incarcerated persons thought it was coming. And if it needs to be updated, is that going to be communicated with them?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Lee Devotny, when we testified about MRA and its implementation, we said that at the time it would be 18 to 24 months for the purposes of developing the policy. Statutorily, there's a requirement that the DOC begin doing the assessment work by January of 2025. That has been implemented and was started, I believe, almost a year ago, where we started to really do assessments of everybody coming in through the standardized kind of assessment process. So we are on pace on that front. Certainly, we understand that the people who are incarcerated, and especially those people who have done well, would love to see us just open the doors. And at the same time, we also heard loud and clear when the floor debate was going on about MRA, the significant concerns that were expressed on the House floor about its implementation and making sure that this is thoughtfully implemented. And so as we look to put this in place, we have been communicating with the population. We've engaged with the population around what this process looks like, and we've tried to educate about just the complexity of implementing a substantive change like this in a system. I mean, this changes everything in terms of the way we approach our work. It builds incentive as the centerpiece of what it is we're trying to accomplish with the sole purpose of trying to reduce recidivism and incarceration. And so we want to make sure we're doing that right. We know that and would love to, as we learn, and we begin this implementation in February after publishing the policy in January, which is what we said from the beginning, we will work to try and expedite that implementation process. But really that has to be done on the basis of good learning, because we learned and have heard loud and clear, in particular from the First Step Act folks at the Bureau of Prisons, the federal level, where Congress, and again, as I said, mentioned President Trump passing that into law, they had some challenges when they implemented this as well. And I think it was because it is a massive shift in how we do our business. So we will get there, and we want to get there as quickly as we possibly can. But from a communication standpoint, we've heard those critiques, and yet we're trying to be responsive to, I think, the interest of what we heard from the legislature in the debates on the floor, and really this some levels of concern about doing it at all, and we want to make sure we're doing it right.
Lead him at me.
Thank you, Chair.
Commissioner Stell, if you could just, if some way you could put together a letter that we could get out so we'd have an ability to respond to these families. I know we'd all appreciate that. I'm sure the other site's getting the same emails.
Madam Chair, Lee Devotney, we absolutely put that together for you.
Thank you.
All right, and we are running up against time, but I just want to see if members have questions for any of our other testifiers before we wrap up. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was interested in asking a question of Assistant Commissioner Miles.
All right. The Assistant Commissioner can come on up then. Go ahead and ask your question while he's coming up to the table.
Sure. So as it relates to the trip to Maine, excuse me, and just the comparison and contrast between what they've done there and what we're looking to implement here with MRRA, what was their context like in terms of, so repeat things we've heard today is the issues with infrastructure, 33%, one-third of our state's deferred maintenance in the system, $723 million required just to bring it up to fair condition, despite the 97% staffing level. It still sounds like staffing is continually cited as a obstacle to implementing programs. What was their context like, and what could we learn from that?
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative. We were only there for a couple of days, but their staffing level was doing, they were well-staffed, according to the commissioner who, or the correct commissioner who was doing grounds for us in the Wharton. I guess that's the question I have, that their staffing was very good. They didn't have, because they have honor units, they didn't use staff as we traditional prisons do, where you have three or four staff members in a unit. They just had staff that would go in once an hour, as I stated earlier, that would do rounds. So that gave them some additional staff to use in other areas as well. So I think that's how they're able to do some of the things that they're doing.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner, so when we took our tours of your facilities around the state, we repeatedly heard about space issues being a barrier to implementing programs to move this thing forward with people having things to do, not having idle hands. How much of that would be improved by providing that funding necessary to bring the system up to fair condition?
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative. I think it would be significantly improved. First of all, our staffing is significantly improved. So we're able to do things that we wasn't able to do before. So when you guys came through, I remember all of you coming through, our staffing was poor, and we're much, much better now. So we're getting back to some normalcy in our facilities. Implementing some of these new strategies, I think, will allow us some opportunity to be able to use our staffing in different areas, to be able to use some of the space that we do may have where we don't have bodies, we have space. I think we can then use our staff better in those ways to where we can get more programming going.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else for the Assistant Commissioner or for any other testifiers? We've been sitting for a long time, so understand people need to take a break. I just want to thank not only the members, the staff again, all of our testifiers, everybody who was here with us today. Thank you so much. I think that these conversations are really important as we move forward. To those members that are retiring from the committee, best wishes, and thanks for your service and participation. Also, we have tons of treats left for anybody in the audience that wants a little sugar before you leave. Please help yourself. We'll see you in January. With that, we are adjourned.